You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Nasim Chatta, who works at the Alliance for Global Justice, AFGJ. She is the coordinator for the Prison Imperialism Project. She uncovers and analyzes the way the U.S. builds and manages prisons in other countries. Her writing has appeared in Mask Magazine, Truth Out, The Abolitionist, and Upside Down Magazine. You can learn more about the issues she researches at afgj.org/prison-imperialism. We'll have the link up at talknationradio.org. Nasim Chatta, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on, and thanks for educating me on this topic already. I imagine I'm not alone in being unaware that the U.S. is putting prisons in other countries. What is this international U.S. prison management program?
Yeah, so this is something that's run out of the U.S. State Department. And basically, this entails over 100 U.S. prison advisors in different countries around the world. The U.S. is involved in the prisons of 38 different countries, deploying people to Latin America, Africa, and some in Asia as well, mostly. So there's been tens of thousands of foreign correctional officers from around the world trained in U.S. incarceration techniques. Beyond that, the U.S. has built new prisons. There have been 6 new prisons built in Colombia since this program started there in 2000. And the U.S. has prisons designed for completion right now in Niger. We believe that there are many other countries as well where the U.S. has actually built prisons. So this started in 2000 in Colombia, and it subsequently spread all around the world. It's characterized by a shift overall towards a culture of militarized containment and retribution rather than rehabilitation. That's the type of thing that the U.S. is teaching in providing funding for other countries to implement. Within the State Department, the funding mostly comes through international narcotics and law enforcement, but not exclusively. And it's usually accompanied by broader programs of justice sector restructuring. The police and the courts are also things that the U.S. has gotten involved in every single one of these countries where we're involved in the prison system.
I was not aware that this was going on. I mean, I knew of all the prisons in countries that the United States occupies, including Afghanistan and Iraq, so many prison camps. Does this come out of that, or this comes out of efforts begun in Colombia?
Yeah, so that's actually interesting that you bring that up, because the U.S. has had these black sites in the Middle East, but we've also been doing the exact same thing. We've actually built prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's under the same type of model, although the funding is kind of directed through the war on terror rather than the war on drugs. But actually, there's two different kinds of prisons that the U.S. is involved with globally. So there's the kinds that are U.S.-run, and those would be Guantanamo, the CIA black site, these sort of secret places where torture goes on. And then there are the types of places that are technically run by other countries, although functionally often the difference is quite blurry. So these things were actually conceived around the same time and as part of the same project. Before 9/11, Colombia was one of the largest recipients of U.S. aid, and we were spending billions on billions of dollars there. We were fighting this expensive war on drugs, getting deeply enmeshed in this ongoing social and political conflict. So the first prison that we built in Colombia was called La Tramacua, and that opened up in 2001. Guantanamo was established, the prison at Guantanamo was established in 2002. And so actually the two types of things, one technically run by Colombians, one run by the U.S., they were deeply enmeshed. And then in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, we actually did build, as I said, we actually did build up their prison systems in a similar way to what we did in Colombia. And then in some of these prisons, like the one in Colombia, the U.S. Bureau of Prisons had an office inside of the prison building when it was first built. And looking back, U.S. State Department officials sort of talk about this as if it was sort of one larger initiative. Like William Brownfield was recently quoted saying that we get a C-plus to B-minus on getting Colombia, Afghanistan, and Iraq to use their prison systems in a way that meets their counter-narcotic, anti-crime, or counter-terrorism objectives. So functionally, it's all sort of part of the same larger project of strengthening. I mean, the supposed rationale is to strengthen the world's prisons in order to be able to hold these high-profile narco-trafficking criminals or high-profile terror suspects. Although the rationale is, I would argue, quite different from the real reasons, which are to maintain and create U.S. dominance on a world scale.
I'm guessing the U.S. public has never been asked whether it wanted this sort of initiative. I don't know if you know, anti-prison activists within the U.S. are aware and engaged with this. How did AFGJ find out about this and become involved in this?
Yeah, the U.S. public has absolutely not been asked. These are pretty clandestine programs that the U.S. is running. The State Department will put out these very long reports about what they've been doing, and sort of deep within, it'll say, oh, and we trained X number of guards in this country. But much of it really isn't public. So we started finding out about this in 2009. At that time, I still hadn't started working for AFGJ, but one of my coworkers was working with groups that were supporting political prisoners in Colombia. And so activists of different stripes were getting jailed by the government in Colombia. And many people were seeing, so many people here and in Colombia were noticing that a lot of the political prisoners were being sent to one particular new prison called La Tramacua. And this is kind of an unusual prison by Colombian standards. Like, it's off really far away from many things. It's off in this part of Colombia that's very hot and also kind of far away from major cities. It's designed as this maximum security facility. And it's also exceptionally poorly designed. Like, it gets about 10 minutes of water to prisoners per day. There's fecal contamination in the food. A majority of the population inside was reportedly sick. And there were repeated incidences of torture as well. So our allies in Colombia were telling us that this was a U.S.-built prison that the Colombian political prisoners were being locked up in. And so my coworker who was involved in this thought to himself, oh, that's a first. Like, we knew that the U.S. was deeply involved in the police and the military and the justice sector, but he was curious about this prison thing, which seemed very new. So he started reading State Department documents and U.S. State Department documents, and he found out that there was something called Program for the Improvement of Colombian Prisons, which had been signed by both U.S. and Colombia. And this was, we believe, part of the larger Plan Colombia, which was a security agreement between the U.S. and Colombia. So we learned that there was a plan for over a dozen new prisons. As it turns out, six have actually been built since the inception of this program. And then he kept on kind of poking around in these State Department documents, reading the Program for the Improvement of Colombian Prisons, this very dense document. And it mentioned that the U.S. was involved in the prison systems of over 20 countries around the world. Now we know that the total is more like 38 countries. So that's how we initially found out about it. We initially didn't know really what to think of this, like because we really couldn't find very much about it. So we've had to find out kind of backwards, essentially, like since the State Department will not say how the money is being spent, they won't lay out the exact countries where they're involved in prison management programs. We've had to sort of look at each country and trace backwards whether the U.S. has been involved in the prison system.
And it's not, Nassim, it's not just U.S. running prisons and training people how to run prisons, but also, as you mentioned, criminal justice policies and using people like Rudy Giuliani to train people to lock more people up for smaller crimes for longer times, so that incarceration rates are increasing along with the prison construction. Is that right?
This is an example of broken windows-style policing. So as Colombian prisons have had more and more space opened up by these new prisons that the U.S. has helped build, they've just quickly filled it up. So more things like drug crimes are now offenses for which people can be incarcerated in Colombia. And this is really one of the biggest U.S. priorities, is to go into countries where we're fighting this supposed war on drugs and restructure their justice system so they're prioritizing things like drug crimes. Another sort of interesting example is copyright offenses. Like, the U.S. really doesn't want its intellectual property to be used in other countries, so we'll often go in and kind of push them to prioritize criminalizing copyright offenses, sort of things that really have little to do with the health and public safety of their country, drug crimes, and then also to push them to restructure their justice system so that they're criminalizing terror in the way that the U.S. wants them to be criminalizing terrorism.
We're speaking with Nassim Chatta, who works for the Alliance for Global Justice. It seems bizarre for the U.S. to be exporting something that it's sort of the worst at in the world, but apparently there's something called the International Correctional Management Training Center, a school in Colorado since 2011, where people are brought and trained, and as far as I know, there aren't any big protests outside the gate, as at the School of the Americas. I don't know if there's any opposition. What do you know about this place and its activities?
You know, not much. I don't really know much about what gets taught there, and I really would love to know. They haven't released anything about the syllabus or the things that they're teaching. So I don't really know. And I would love to know so we could evaluate it. This is basically a clandestine program. One thing that's sort of interesting is there's at least one private company that's involved in this, Colorado Corrections Industries. And presumably they get government contracts to operate these trainings. Training for international guards.
Oh, they're getting contracts for the trainings. What about who's getting contracts for the prisons in foreign countries? I mean, who's getting rich off of this, if anyone?
We would love to know that. We did submit a FOIA request recently, and so we didn't get anything back. Not a big surprise, but we would absolutely love to know who is getting the contracts to build the prisons, do the food, the phone service. We've heard rumors that in Honduras, it's a U.S. company that's running the phone systems in Honduran prisons. But, yeah, so far nothing hard and fast that we can point to show that somebody is getting rich off of this.
In your article or that you wrote at Truth Out or in another that you sent me, I saw a reference to prison industries, which sounded like code for slave labor, which is something that has a strike going on now in the state of Florida. Is that part of the plan to put prisoners to work in these prisons?
That was in the BuzzFeed article I didn't actually write that one, but I thought that was interesting, and it was interesting that it was somewhat uncritical. Like, from what I understand, the U.S. is teaching the prison guards of other countries to put prisoners to work at some type of industry, and little was said about who gets the profits from that. Are those supposed to be the profits that run the prisons? Do the prisoners have a choice? And why are we teaching this around the world? I don't know.
I think it was in your article, though, that you touched on some of the ways that these prisons are different from other prisons, that isolating prisoners and depriving them of sunlight and solitary confinement were sort of not what prisons in Honduras were used to. That this was a U.S. prison model. Is that right?
Yeah. So the U.S. prison system is actually quite distinct in a world scale. Like, some of the things that characterize U.S. prisons, the unusual things that characterize U.S. prisons, we accept as quite normal. Like the fact that many of our prisons are very far away from population centers, which can be really destructive for families here in the U.S. Like, they have to take long bus rides to see their family members, for example. That's unusual in other countries where prisons are often located in the areas where the prisoners are from. Like, for example, Mexico didn't even have federal prisons until pretty recently, and we're almost certain that this is a U.S. influence, the creation of these federal prisons where prisoners convicted of so-called federal crimes would be sent to these big maximum security facilities far, far away. So that's a major characteristic of prisons that the U.S. builds. These prisons that are in population centers are often, at least from what I've seen in Latin America, they're in these buildings that are kind of indistinguishable from just the buildings around them, except for they don't have windows. They are easily accessed by walking there, transit, things like that. A big characteristic of U.S. prisons is, I mean, honestly, that they look just like U.S. prisons. Like they sit on big pieces of land and have multiple layers of barbed wire fencing, like multiple checkpoints to get in. The ones that I've seen are also heavily patrolled and militarized by either military or police. I saw one in Honduras that is one of their new U.S.-built maximum security prisons, and it looked exactly like it had just dropped from the sky, like from the United States intact. It looked exactly like a U.S. prison, basically. And so the idea is that these are going to be hyper-secure prisons. In reality, they're basically theaters of intimidation. They're not really more secure. Like, it's not actually super dangerous people that are being locked up who are now more securely held. Because in reality, when prisoners get let out of prison in Latin America, it's often just due to corruption. So the corruption is still there, if not more so. And so prisoners can just be let out by guards. Like, there have been some really high-profile breakouts of gang members from these prisons that the U.S. has helped to build. So that's one big shift in prisons that the U.S. is helping to influence, is making them far away, really militarized. And then another thing that the U.S. is encouraging is solitary confinement, supposedly as a gang and terror group control strategy, but really it gets used on all kinds of people, including political dissidents and just regular people who have been convicted of crime. So the people that we spoke to in Honduras, the people who did basically social work in prisons, were saying that the conditions, which are supposed to be better in these U.S. prisons, at least that's what the rationale is, the conditions are actually way worse because the prisons are way more punitive than they are now. And the rationale, the mood now in these justice systems and these prisons is just lock people up, fill up all the beds, use it as kind of this tool of basically scaring people and creating terror in their own population.
I wonder, Nassim, how some of these prisons relate to U.S. strategies in terms of militaries and war, because, I mean, you call this the prison imperialism project, and I think it may have been in that same BuzzFeed article, it sounded like they were using one of these prisons in Niger to lock up essentially enemies in war, terrorist organization members who even subsequently attacked one of the prisons to try to free the prisoners. Is that part of this model, is that it's to be used for prisoners of war?
Absolutely. So from the very beginning, this has been a part of these prison management programs. We found out about these prison programs through our work with political prisoners in Colombia, who were all kinds of people, like labor activists, just campesino, like country farmer organizers. Some of them were communist guerrilla group members. So the political dissidents and have been locked up in these prisons that the U.S. is building since the very beginning. And that's actually central to why the U.S. is building these prisons around the world. We call this prison imperialism. Basically, that's because these prisons are always in very poor places, almost always in the global south, in countries that are U.S. proxies in their respective regions. So when the U.S. goes in and builds prisons and restructures systems, we not only see increases in numbers of prisoners, but also an increase in political arrest, because we're basically handing these neoliberal corrupt governments a new tool to repress their own citizens. Prisons are for this reason, a main part of the infrastructure of empire, which also includes police and military and economic infrastructure. At AFGJ, Alliance for Global Justice, we think prisons are central to this because they're this new way of exerting control around the world. In that, it's kind of seen as part of civil society rather than explicit military control. So it's sort of seen as, or the State Department would like to portray it as, this basically charitable tool that they're handing these countries as part of aid, but really as part of repressing populations in places where the U.S. may be in something like war.
Do you think that anti-war groups should be opposing foreign prisons, and that anti-prison activists should be opposing foreign prisons, and is any of that going on? And what do you recommend people do who want to help?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I do think that it would make a lot of sense. And so far there has been a really long history, especially in Black nationalism, to be anti-imperialist. So those are groups that are really connecting the U.S. control of populations of Black people in the U.S., and they're saying that that's the exact type of thing that the U.S. is doing by being this imperial power worldwide. So there is a really long history, but because these U.S. prison programs are basically pretty unknown, like the U.S. government hides them, and there are these sort of clandestinely run things where, like, literally no data is released about them, it's hard to kind of build a movement around that. But that's basically the U.S.'s strategy, is to be very secretive and kind of conceal all its bases around the world. Like, all the U.S. bases in Africa we only know about because of a FOIA request. And that was really recently, even though the program has been going on, even though those bases have been being built for a really long time. So, yes, absolutely, anti-war activists need to be opposing the U.S. prison imperialism worldwide, and also be opposing mass incarceration and, in my opinion, the entire prison system here in the U.S., and vice versa, activists working against the prison system and mass incarceration here in the U.S. need to understand that this has become a global phenomenon. So they have more allies, perhaps, than they even know all around the world.
We've got just a minute left. Nassim Chatta from Alliance for Global Justice. Can people help AFGJ in this work? Where can we send people to help?
People can check out our website at afgj.org/prisonimperialism, prison-imperialism. My contact information is up there. At this point, we're really trying to learn more. So one of the best things people could do is try to dig into this and do research about the specific countries they know a lot about, and figure out if and why the U.S. is building prisons there. So we would love to work with more people and to kind of crowdsource information about this, because really the U.S. government is not releasing anything.
So all you researchers listening, get involved. We've been speaking with Nassim Chatta, who is the coordinator for the Prison Imperialism Project at the Alliance for Global Justice, AFGJ. We'll have all the links up at talknationradio.org. Nassim, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, economic news is presented as facts and figures, but it's also, maybe most importantly, a story, a narrative. But whether it's an article about companies using their tax cut savings to give workers bonuses, or one about how few of them are actually doing that, corporate media's economic reporting stays within a certain mindset, in which the propriety of a small set of corporate executives and shareholders deciding how they fancy divvying up the profits of the work of the employees is a given. The current U.S. economic system, despite exorbitant health care costs and the highest infant mortality rate in the developed world, despite entrenched and increasing inequality, despite an actually declining life expectancy, is understood to be functioning essentially as it should. With all eyes on the stock market, we'll take a questioning look at some economic fundamentals with Richard Wolff, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and visiting professor at the New School. He's also the founder of Democracy at Work and host of the weekly TV and radio program Economic Meltdown. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. When congressional Democrats agreed to end the government shutdown in exchange for a vague promise for a future vote on the status of young undocumented immigrants from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, corporate media expressed a consensus. Dreamers weren't worth a shutdown. Joshua Cho looked at the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal from 3 days before to 3 days after the shutdown and found a striking lack of concern for the fate of the Dreamers and many variations of the same take on the need for a bipartisan compromise for immigration reform. Writing for Fair.org, Cho notes that out of 34 op-eds and editorials, only New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg criticized the Democrats for selling out the Dreamers. The majority of pieces argued that it was an inevitable or smart choice. None advocated for the Democratic Party to hold out for a clean Dream Act that would provide a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers that isn't tied to a concurrent clampdown on immigration. The 20 columnists and op-ed contributors were 90% white and 80% male. None were Latino. None were Dreamers or immigration activists. And finally, you saw it coming, and then there it was. Philadelphia Eagles fans set fires, broke into stores, and uprooted lampposts after the Super Bowl, resulting in just 4 arrests. City officials' muted reaction to the crowds of overwhelmingly white male fans was remarked, but media, too, reflected a double standard. Outlets that routinely use the word violence to refer to protests by black and brown people against police shootings now reached for terms like unruliness. That was the New York Times. Philly officials had some cleaning up to do, chuckled AP, after fans turned unruly overnight. The wire service described smashing department store windows, looting a gas station convenience store, and hitting cops with bottles as the actions of rowdies. But as Owen Higgins writes for Fair.org, the reason for the variance may have to do with the motive for the protest, as well as with the racial makeup of the people in the street. Majority white crowds at the WTO protests in Seattle in 2000 and the J20 protests at the 2016 Trump inauguration were each painted by corporate media as violent events based on limited incidents of vandalism. Reporter Sam Adler Bell of Mask notes that policing the use of the term violence is one of the ways the state tries to maintain its monopoly control on the legitimate use of force. In a piece on the J20 arrests, Adler Bell illustrated the contrast, quote, breaking storefront windows, violence, dousing civilians in pepper spray, crowd control, overturning trash bins, violence, hurling stinger grenades at the heads of protesters, maintaining order, close quote. For corporate media as well, not what actually happens, but whether street actions challenge the powers that be would seem to determine whether participants are violent or just taking a good time a little too far. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. It's hard to read headlines about panic and free fall in the stock market and not think you're supposed to feel some kind of way when you get explanations like that of a recent New York Times story that the market's worst week in 2 years was sparked by concerns over increasing wages. It becomes less clear who or what we're meant to be worrying about. Corporate media talk a lot about the economy, but it's a formulaic, jargony kind of reporting that rarely talks about people in any holistic way and virtually never sets itself the question of how life could be better for more people with a differently organized economy. Here to help us sort through recent economic news is Richard Wolff, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and visiting professor now at the New School. He's also founder of Democracy at Work and host of Economic Update, a national TV and radio program. He's the author of several books, most recently Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Richard Wolff.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we hear and we understand in a general way that Wall Street is not the economy. But then what is it? And what is its relationship to the life and livelihood of an average person?
There is a link, although it's tenuous and shaped by many other factors, between the stock market on the one hand and what some economists call the real economy on the other. First of all, just to remember, the stock market is simply a place where people who own shares of stock buy and sell them to one another. And so what goes on there has to do with the interests of the people who own, buy, and sell big blocks of shares. That right away tells you that the vast majority of the people of the United States are not immediately affected by the stock market because, just to give you one metric, 1% of the shareholders own about two-thirds of all the shares. So it's really a tiny number of people and institutions who do the bulk of the trading in the stock market. And they are influenced by many, many factors, only one of which is what's going on Main Street across the country. So unless you are in the 1%, and have a large portfolio, it's called, of stocks, what goes on day by day there is really not terribly relevant to your life situation. But, of course, there is a link because, in the end, these shares of stock that are being bought and sold are shares of ownership in the industries that function in the United States, for example. So it is of some relevance, because if the value of the stocks go up or down, that will affect the decisions all kinds of people make about all kinds of other subjects, and that can impact your life, and so it becomes important. Let me just give you one quick example. Probably the single most important factor in plunging stocks down over the last few days in the way that got all the headlines, one of those factors was the fact that over the last 30 years particularly, and even more over the last 20, the level of debt in the United States, borrowing, outstripped anything we have ever seen in a capitalist country, certainly anything that's ever happened in the United States. Individuals racked up debt on a scale we've never seen before, credit card debt, mortgage debt, automobile loan debt, and the new one, college student debt. We have never had this kind of debt-ridden society before. Corporations did likewise, and the government borrowed. You put all those together, and we suddenly have, over the last 20 years, an economy where everybody is concerned not only about how they're doing in their particular economic activity, but how they're doing in their level of debt. Are they earning enough to pay back the principal they owe, to pay the interest they owe? And when you then have a debt-ridden economy and the beginnings of a trend towards rising interest rates, you can see the panic that can evolve, and that's what we saw this last week. Very great anxiety that rising interest rates, for all kinds of reasons, are going to put an awful lot of people, businesses, and governments who are now deeply debt-ridden into a kind of vice of having to pay more to carry that debt, and it's not clear that they have any ability to earn more. So that means all kinds of consequences, so that what you see in the stock market is a bit of a foretaste, you might say, of trouble coming.
When you talk about debt, I can't help but think that on an individual level, debt is so politically paralyzing. It really sort of shortens your horizon of what you think is possible for you to do in your life.
Absolutely. I mean, I literally read a few minutes ago a very moving analysis from Europe. And it comes from a obstetrician, a woman doctor in Greece, who writes a beautiful kind of story in which her practice in the hospital in Athens where she works is now a kind of a depressed area, because more and more of the young couples coming to talk to her, they cannot afford another child, or if they're a young couple without kids, they really are beginning to think that they're going to be childless, that they're not going to do it. And you can begin to see that something as fundamental as the literal construction of a family is being impacted, because the explanations these young folks are giving is that their job prospects, their income prospects, and the debts they're carrying combine to make a child or another child literally unaffordable.
You know, as we look to make sense of this, to see why things are this way, we are forced back again on media. I mean, for most of us, the media is the interpreter for economic news. You know, it's the press that tell us what the economy means and what indicators matter. Do you think they have us tracking the most meaningful things? Can a person make sense of what's happening to them and their broader society economically via the news media?
No, to be honest with you, not only do I not think so, I think it's almost the opposite. I guess the bottom line for me is that I've discovered that most of what goes into the major curriculum of economics in our society, which I have been a product of and have in fact myself taught, is really not about how the economy works. Most of what is taught to kids in colleges and universities is not what is going on, but it's really an enormous rationalization, an enormous celebration, if you like, of the status quo. It's so bad, this sort of celebrating our system rather than helping people understand it, that the business community long ago, understanding what I've just said to itself, look, it may be very useful in our society to have economics departments celebrate how wonderful our economic system is. But when we actually get a young man or young woman who graduates and comes and works in our businesses, we don't need the rationalization. What we need is a person who understands how it actually works. And they're not getting that in economics departments. And so we have in the United States a very bizarre duality. Every major university in America basically has two economics departments. One is called economics, and there you learn how to love and celebrate and applaud the economic system we have. The other one has a different name. It's called a business school. And in that economics department, because that's what it is, you learn marketing and accounting, and you learn how actual business economics works. And that's that crazy arrangement, which really is bizarre, comes out of this failure, and there's no nicer way to put it, of the economics departments over the decades to face honestly what goes on in an economy and to switch instead to becoming a kind of PR department for the existing system. So that when, and this, I'm sorry I'm taking so long, but then when you get to a bad period of economic history, which is what I think we're in, and we have been in now for quite a while, then you get to the current situation, which is the media keep doing the effort to celebrate when what the public really needs is an honest investigation of what's going wrong, why so many people feel badly, why it's correct for them to do so, why we are so indebted, for example, why it puts us at the knife edge so that the stock market can go through these gyrations. The people who want answers to those questions have to go out of the normal range of economics, because that, as a profession, really doesn't know how to cope with that sort of question.
I guess that's, you know, makes me think of the other question, which is that we don't see in media, we don't see economics as a kind of contested realm. There really is only the system as we currently have it, and it makes it very difficult to think about making a fundamental change in that system. We don't hear that there are economists who think, actually, we should cancel student debt. That would be a great way to juice the economy.
Absolutely.
It's not even presented as like an argument.
No, you know, it's always struck me as bizarre. Even if you are a great lover of capitalism, our system, and you just think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, even if you're like that, if that's your point of view, the fact is that places like, I don't know, let's pick one, the People's Republic of China, for the last 25 years, that economy, which is organized in ways that are different from the one we have here in the United States, that People's Republic of China has achieved the most rapid economic transformation from poor country to superpower economically that we have ever seen in the history of the human race. Okay, that alone would mean we ought to be exploring in our classrooms, in our media, what's that about? How did they accomplish that? That's something that most of the world's people dream of, and so it's an important matter. And now you add a couple of other considerations, that it's the largest country by population on this planet, and it is a superpower, has nuclear weapons and all of that, and you'd say any rational person would understand, of course we have to look at that model of how you do economics, how you organize an economic system, to ask the logical, rational question, not necessarily, you know, we must copy them, but are there things about what they do and how they organize that we might be able to learn something from? I like to point out to my students sometimes that the world's largest debtor country is the United States, and that the largest creditor country of the United States is the People's Republic of China. If nothing else, that should provide a hint, and I'm trying to be polite here, a hint that we ought to explore. And your question is exactly right, because in 99% of the curricula of the United States in economics, there is nothing of the sort. There is no program, no course, certainly no sequence of courses, which is what you would need to do a proper exploration over a year or two or three. There's nothing of the sort. So that when I go and I try to explain to people how that economy is different, you know, I'm starting from scratch. They haven't the faintest idea of what I'm talking about. And worse than that they don't know is that they have no sense in their heads that there's anything there they ought to have been taught, they ought to have learned as just being a citizen and making rational decisions. So another way to put it, we have an economic system in which the enterprises of this country are pretty much organized in the same way. At the top of each enterprise is an owner. The owner can be an individual, can be a family, can be a partnership, but most of the business in America is done by an owner that's called a corporation. It has shareholders. The shareholders elect a board of directors, usually 15, 20 people. And they operate the enterprise. There can be a few hundred employees, there can be a few hundred thousand employees, and everything in between. Now, that's a very interesting way of organizing business. Not the way feudal manors were organized. It's not the way slave plantations were organized. It's peculiar to capitalism. But here's a simple fact which ought to illustrate, in a sense, the question you've asked. This is an extremely undemocratic arrangement. What do I mean? Well, the number of people that make all the key decisions in American corporations, and by that I mean deciding what to produce, deciding how, what technology to use, deciding the physical geographic location, will it be produced in Cincinnati or in Shanghai, etc., and finally, what to do with the profits that the labor of all the people working there have helped to produce. All of those key decisions that shape the lives of everybody involved in a company, and indeed everybody in the larger community, are made by tiny groups of individuals, the major shareholders, that 1% who own three-quarters of the shares or two-thirds of them, and the boards of directors that they choose. This is a tiny minority sitting at the top of every corporation, looking and acting pretty much like kings and queens once acted when there were monarchies instead of democratic parliamentarian systems. And we don't question that, we here in America, with our commitment to democracy. We seem not to be able to ask the obvious question. If we like democracy, as we say we do, if we insist on some sort of accountability of the political leaders who make decisions that impact us, why in the world do we not make the same demand, democratic accountability, of the economic leaders in our society, the people who run these enormous corporations that are the dominant economic factor in our society? And we don't. And the funny thing is that, of course, there is an alternative. Just like there was an alternative to monarchy, namely political democracy, there's an alternative to the hierarchical, top-down capitalist corporation. And it has a number of names because it's very old. The one that's being used much these days is worker cooperative or producer cooperative. And the basic idea is we would have a different economy if we organized our enterprises in an alternative way, namely instead of hierarchical or vertical with a tiny unaccountable leadership at the top. We didn't do that. We said there is no leadership, or to put it differently, if there isn't a leadership, it has to be elected by the workers in an enterprise. They have to have the right to recall these people. In other words, that the workers in a place have democratic rights in the workplace that are roughly analogous to the politically democratic rights we have in the communities where we live. If you did that, all the decisions that we have lived with and that have produced the economic problems with which this conversation began would be different. Americans who seem to be surprised, at least in my experience, to discover that we have a highly unequal distribution of wealth and income. Why we're surprised by that is, for me, a mystery. If you allow the decisions on how to distribute the profits of an enterprise to be made by a tiny group of shareholders and the boards of directors they select at the top of every enterprise, why are you surprised that they who have that power use it to distribute the bulk of the profits of an enterprise to themselves in the form of dividends to the shareholders and tremendous pay packages to the top executives? Those are the people making the decision, and they make them in their own interest, and the rest of us have to borrow money to send our kids to college. In a democratically organized enterprise where everybody in the enterprise, you know, has one person, one vote, they wouldn't distribute it all equally. They would recognize some workers have greater skill or had to get more education or so forth and so on. But they would never in a million years give a handful of people tens of millions of dollars, and everybody else, you know, has to borrow money, send their kid to college. If you really wanted to deal with the inequality in our society, which almost everybody says they do, well, investigating an alternative way to organize the economy is at least one of the ways that ought to be explored. But none of what I've just taken your time to explain is in our daily press, is in our media, is being explored in the media in such a way to stimulate people's thinking about it, to present what the alternatives are, and to create that informed public without which the claim to be a democratic society rings rather hollow.
We've been speaking with Richard Wolff. He's Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, now visiting professor at the New School. He's founder of Democracy at Work and host of Economic Update. Richard Wolff, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure, and also my appreciation for exploring precisely what it is that needs to be explored more.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
New science reveals Earth's protective ozone shield is still thinning, despite a long-standing international agreement to protect it, and no matter what you've heard about the big ozone holes over the poles healing themselves. Our risk of cancer and eye damage continues. From Zurich, Switzerland, we will talk with the lead author of that breaking science. But there's more, and you won't hear this from the mainstream media. Another just-published paper suggests that thinning ozone may have driven the planet's biggest mass extinction of land plants and animals. We have to rethink how extinction happens. We don't understand it. And we have to reevaluate the mega risk of thinning ozone. The lead author from University of California, Berkeley, will take us on that odyssey in our second half of the show. This is Radio Eco Shock. We all know the 1989 ban on ozone-depleting chemicals was a success. The protective ozone shield is recovering. Except it isn't. And that is according to a stunning new paper published February 6th in the European journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. We've reached the lead author, Dr. William Ball, in Switzerland. He is a visiting lecturer and researcher at the Institute for Atmospheric and Climate Science at ETH Zurich. He also works with the Davos World Radiation Center. Dr. Ball, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Your new paper, you know, it's one of the things I love about science. It doubts and it prods. What led you and your international team to question whether world ozone is recovering, despite reports that the polar ozone holes are mending?
This is really interesting, Alex. I think this is one of these tales of finding something new when you weren't even looking for it. I mean, the area of research I was doing a few years ago and still continue to do today is to try and understand how variability in the sun can influence on the atmosphere and the climate. And one of the ways it can do that is through modulating ozone in the upper stratosphere. So originally, in order to estimate how the sun can affect ozone in the upper stratosphere, in the upper atmosphere, what you need to have is lots of a long time series, lots of data sets covering a long period of time that have been merged together into a composite. And it's from those, when you apply statistical analyses, that you can extract the solar signal. This was the starting point. And the problem is that we have no satellite lives for very long. I think the longest living ozone-observing satellite is about 20 years long, and variously they live from 5 to 10 years when in orbit. And when you put the data together, various teams around the world put the data together, and you can, when you pull out the solar signal, you get different solar signals based on different data sets, different composites. And so what we wanted to do is understand why we're getting a different solar signal, because there's only one sun, there's only one real variability in the atmosphere from the sun. And we developed methods to account for the differences between them. And when we did this, we saw a very clear recovery in the upper stratosphere, in addition to being able to extract the solar cycle. But what was really concerned us was that we saw this decrease in the lower stratosphere. And because we had applied these methods, these new algorithms to do this, we were confident that what we were seeing in the lower stratosphere was probably robust and real. And this then became of concern to us. So then we started our deep analysis that has turned into this paper in the last few days.
Brilliant. But before we go too much further, we do have to explain to some of the people what makes ozone in the first place, and then what makes it so important for life here on Earth. Now, that's a big topic. But let's just get a snapshot view of that, if we could.
So the presence of ozone in the atmosphere is really a consequence of the sun, actually. So we have oxygen in our atmosphere, the same oxygen that we breathe. And when it's high up in the atmosphere, the very, very strong ultraviolet radiation, high-energy radiation from the sun, the very radiation that actually the ozone layer protects us from, is able to break apart the oxygen molecule, which is made of two oxygen atoms, into two free oxygen atoms. And then what happens is that single oxygen atom then combines with an oxygen molecule. So you get the two plus the one, and you get this molecule containing three oxygens, and that's ozone. And the very presence of this ozone that's now been formed from this high-energy radiation leads to a formation of a shield that protects us from more damaging radiation from different other wavelengths that are harmful to us. And this is very interesting because until oxygen sort of appeared in our atmosphere maybe 600 million years ago or further back in time, the ozone layer didn't really form until this oxygen came into the atmosphere and allowed life now to exist on land about 600 million years ago. So it's the presence of this ozone layer that allows life to persist outside of the oceans and is protected from ultraviolet radiation that actually is quite damaging to DNA, can cause all sorts of diseases, particularly skin cancer is a major one, or cataracts. So its presence here is essential to our survival and for the survival of the biosphere.
It's my understanding from your paper that ozone is mainly produced in the tropics. Then the question becomes, how and why does it migrate toward the poles?
The largest production of ozone in the atmosphere does occur over the tropics. It's sort of also at the subtropics, so out to about 30 north and south. And it gets to varying lesser degrees the further away you get from there. But the reason why we have a protective shield from the ozone layer all around the planet is because there is a large-scale circulation pattern. It's called the Brewer-Dobson circulation, which basically is a slow kind of equatorial to polar convection of air, which spreads out the ozone produced in the tropics to the mid-latitudes and the high latitudes. And this basically forms through several branches. So the stratosphere itself begins roughly about 10 to 15 kilometers above the Earth's surface, depending on where you live. If you're living at mid-latitudes, like in North America or in Europe, that'll be about 10 kilometers above you. So when you go on a transatlantic flight, you're roughly at the location at where the stratosphere starts, and it's above you, and that's where the ozone layer starts. And these branches are important because there are several of them. There's one in the shallow branch that takes ozone from the lower tropics into the lower mid-latitudes. And there's one that comes from the lower tropics and heads up to the highest altitudes in the tropical region, about 50 kilometers. And then it transports ozone slowly into the mid-latitudes or even higher and then down into the polar region to feed ozone into the polar region and into the mid-latitudes.
So there's a whole circulation system going on up there, but I was wondering, why is it important what happens to ozone in the lower stratosphere, closer to Earth, where you found it was thinning, if ozone in the upper stratosphere may be recovering?
So that's a very good question, and this is an issue that sort of complicates the previous picture following the Montreal Protocol, that we were expecting the entire ozone layer to recover. I think what's really important here is that the upper stratosphere does appear to be recovering thanks to the implementation of the Montreal Protocol. But what we found in terms of decreases in the lower portion of the stratosphere seems to be of a slightly larger magnitude than the recovery we see above. So when you add up the contributions in the long-term changes, the changes in the lower stratosphere seem to largely win out over the upper stratosphere. I think it's an important point you raise. I mean, at the end of the day, it's not so much an issue of where the ozone is recovering or changing, but what that, in terms of our protection from damaging radiation at the surface, it's what's the total change in all the ozone between us and the top of the atmosphere. So this is what we call the total column ozone. And this includes ozone in the troposphere, that's the air near the surface where all the clouds are, where we live, and in the stratosphere, in the ozone layer itself. So it's the changes in all of these together that tell us about the total protection and how that's changing in the total column. So it's not so much where it is. But at the end of the day, our results seem to suggest that the changes in the lower part are winning out over the recovery in the upper part. And unfortunately, that suggests that there's been a very marginal continued decrease in stratospheric ozone in the last 20 years. Or at least today, it's slightly lower than it was 20 years ago.
We've all seen graphics showing the ozone hole over Antarctica shrinking with predictions it would be gone by the middle of this century. William Ball, what do you think?
I have to, in this case, defer to what I've learned from other scientists, from other experts. So even within the ozone layer community, there are experts in various different areas. And so I work more on looking at trends and variability in mid-latitudes and tropical regions. But from what I can see in my understanding of the atmosphere from my studies, I think that there's very clear evidence that the predictions for a recovery are very much in line with our modeling studies. And as far as I can see, I would have nothing to disagree with the expectations that by maybe 2065 or so, our climate models, our chemistry climate models, should suggest a recovery. And it takes quite a long time because the chlorofluorocarbons, these CFCs, in the atmosphere have a long residence time. So it will take a while before much of this has been sort of cleared out from the atmosphere and no longer has such a significant impact on the Antarctic ozone hole.
But could that ozone hole recover, and yet we still have thinning ozone overall, as your paper's been discussing?
That's right. So the results from our paper don't have a direct impact on the recent findings of a recovery in the ozone hole itself. So these are quite different regions of the planet that undergo different mechanisms that are dominating the changes. So you can't say, particularly from the work that we've found, that this has any sort of direct first-order impact on what's going on in the polar regions. For example, we also see the recovery in the upper stratosphere, and that's unaffected by whatever's driving the changes in the lower stratosphere from what we can tell.
Now, another sort of layman's question. I know that here at Earth's surface, we create ozone, we humans, by providing these precursors, nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds, also called VOCs, and then sunlight comes along and that becomes an unhealthy smog. What I'm wondering is, does that surface level ozone that we create eventually rise up into the stratosphere? And if so, would that affect Earth's ozone balance?
So you're absolutely right about the production of these of ozone from the surface and from pollution from our own sources of industry and cars and cities, etc. But to answer your first question, no, not really. So the most of the ozone produced at the surface, it doesn't typically get up into the stratosphere, and if it does, it would be very, very small quantities that would have really very little effect on the ozone layer, the stratospheric ozone layer balance itself. So the tropospheric ozone is largely removed from the atmosphere through a process called dry deposition, so it tends to get removed by interacting with the surface and things. And also when tropospheric ozone gets into regions where there's very, very low levels of a substance called NOx, nitrogen oxide, it also typically can then get destroyed and removed from other processes. So it doesn't typically get up there. It is worth bringing up the point that in the total column, as I was mentioning before, that is the total amount of ozone between us and the sun, about 90% of it resides in the stratosphere and 10% resides in the troposphere. And there is some exchange more from the stratosphere to bring ozone into the troposphere rather than the other way around. That's more the way it works.
Is it more serious, Will, that ozone is not recovering between 60 degrees north and 60 degrees south, where most of the human population and most animals and plants live?
Oh, that's a very good question. So I would start out by first of all saying that at the moment, again, the thing that we need to be most concerned about at the surface is the total column ozone. So how many molecules of ozone lie between us and the sun? And from our analysis and from other studies, it's clear that this hasn't changed that much in the last 20 years. So in terms of our protection from ultraviolet radiation, we shouldn't panic. We shouldn't be overly worried at the moment because we still have this protective layer between us. But it is worth pointing out that, of course, the total column ozone isn't recovering at the moment or hasn't recovered significantly to levels before CFC started to be used in large quantities and led to the decreases we saw prior to the implementation of the Montreal Protocol. But thanks to the Montreal Protocol, we are sort of in a situation where we're still relatively well protected, especially with the uses of sunscreen and protecting ourselves from the sun when we're out in it for too long. But it is, again, worth reiterating that any levels of decrease in the ozone layer has the potential to enhance DNA damage. In some sense, it is serious because the reason why the implications from our study for the reasons why the total column hasn't gone down in line with the small decreases we see in the stratospheric column is because essentially we've got tropospheric ozone coming to the rescue. And tropospheric ozone is not a good thing that we want to have rescuing us because it's a health and respiratory hazard, and it's damaging also to animals and plants. So this is a more speculative point to add, but as has been going on in Europe and America, should the world get to a point where it starts to clean up the pollution that causes tropospheric ozone, and we don't see changes that are positive in terms of the lower stratospheric ozone going back up or it continues to go down, and this is highly speculative because we don't know what the trajectory of stratospheric ozone is, then that might then start to become something that we'd have more concern about.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. William Ball in Zurich, and researchers from Switzerland, the UK, America, Sweden, Finland, and Canada have used NASA satellites, the European Space Agency, and a Canadian satellite to show that Earth's ozone shield is not recovering as we all thought it would. And you've started to discuss why ozone is not recovering as expected. That's going to be everybody's big question. But before we go there, I just want to take a small detour into an earlier paper you co-authored that really caught my attention. And I'm referring to one called Atmospheric Impacts of the Strongest Known Solar Particle Storm of 775 AD. Was published March 28, 2017 in Nature Scientific Reports. What are solar energetic particles, and can they deplete stratospheric ozone?
Yeah, so this is a really nice study led by my colleague Timofey Sukhodolov, and this was looking into an historic event that was detected in the paleo record from carbon record from measurements and tree rings of a very, very large solar particle storm. So A solar particle storm is essentially the product of a large eruption on the sun's surface that blows out lots of very high-energy particles, protons and electrons. And if it happens to be in the direction of the Earth, then these things will plow into the Earth's atmosphere, typically following along magnetic field lines that protect us and channeling them into high latitudes. And you're right, it does have an effect on stratospheric ozone. But this is sort of usually these events typically are focused in high-latitude polar regions, and they would tend to impact the upper stratosphere and the lower mesosphere. So this is the layer even higher up than the stratosphere. Typically will produce these ions of what we call NOx and HOX, which can then lead to destruction of ozone in the upper stratosphere. But as far as we're aware, the effect is generally quite small on a sort of typical one of these events. They can be relatively large, but they tend to be short-lived. So they don't tend to be something that, from the surface point of view, we have to worry about, especially since it's at high latitudes, few people live. So there's not much effect in terms of the column ozone that we observe.
Are there other instances of serious ozone depletion in deep history? And so could our current problem be just a long-term cycle or a reaction to some non-human causes?
That's a good question. I mean, I personally don't really have a lot of knowledge about the long-term changes in the ozone layer. And, of course, there are little, if anything, in terms of observations. I mean, one would have to go to the modeling studies to look long, far back in history, you know, over tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. And so then you're in a situation where you'd be looking at using models which already have all the hypotheses in. Now, one of the hypotheses we put forward for the potential decrease in lower stratospheric ozone is a potential response to climate change, which is a warming of the troposphere, the lower atmosphere. And we know, of course, in the past that on very long timescales, there are slow changes in temperature that match where we've been today in the past. So the mechanisms that might drive a change in ozone, again, we might have seen similar things in the past, but we don't know what the mechanism is driving the lower stratospheric ozone. And from what we know from our models, we don't really reproduce this change that we're seeing now. So, but it's still possible it could be related to climate change. And so it may have happened in the past. But again, this is highly speculative. I don't have any evidence to support this line of thinking. It's just coming from what I know in terms of modeling studies.
And then others have suggested that very short-lived substances, or VSLSs, have a role in the ozone story. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, the honest answer is that they might. So to explain, very short-lived substances are compounds, that the ones that at least we have evidence that are increasing are man-made. And these are similar to chlorofluorocarbons in that they're molecules, compounds containing chlorine and bromine, which are the key things that were in chlorofluorocarbons and ozone-depleting substances that were banned by the Montreal Protocol. And very short-lived substances, they're called very short-lived simply because they typically are only thought to survive about 6 to 12 months in the atmosphere, not long enough to get up into the stratosphere. And so they haven't been regulated by the Montreal Protocol because they haven't been considered to be a serious threat. There's been a few studies recently, a couple of modeling ones, where they've shown that there is the potential for the rises in or increases in emissions of VSLSs over the last few decades, if they continue, could potentially have a slowing effect on the recovery of the ozone layer, but not to the extent that they would prevent it. And just a few months ago, there was a study that showed that there were actually much higher levels of these emissions or concentrations above the surface over Southeast Asia, and indeed even levels higher than expected close to the interface region that will then bring the air containing VSLSs into the lower stratosphere. But there is no direct evidence of high concentrations of these VSLSs that could potentially have the impacts that we are seeing in terms of the decreases in lower stratospheric ozone. So again, this is a hypothesis that would need to be investigated.
The success of the 1989 Montreal Protocol has been held up as a model of international action to solve a life-threatening environmental problem, and some say it inspired the Paris Accord on climate change. Your new scientific announcement about the ozone, it's not happy news, either for environmental safety, obviously, but also for the political process. Your thoughts on that?
That's an interesting question. I think the first thing I would say is that we need to be careful about mixing what we've found here with the political process in terms of protecting the ozone layer through the Montreal Protocol. So the first thing to say is that the study doesn't have anything to say in terms of the effectiveness of the Montreal Protocol, because we know that the Montreal Protocol has been highly successful. We see a closing of the Antarctic ozone hole in the last few years. Studies are starting to confirm this in line with our expectations. It's very clear that in the upper stratosphere there is a recovery underway and that ozone is recovering up there in line with our projections from chemistry climate model studies. And in some sense, even more important, it's clear that the total column has stopped declining. That's the total protection and in terms of the ozone between us and the sun. This is fantastic news, and that's the result of this political process that led to the Montreal Protocol and all of its amendments. So had the Montreal Protocol not been implemented, so projections suggest that by 2060, maybe two-thirds of the global protective ozone layer would have been lost. And that would have very serious implications for people living at the surface and life in general living at the surface, let alone the benefits to the radius of forcing in terms of climate change that are avoided. So I would say that this doesn't have an impact on that highly successful political process. Now, from an environmental safety perspective, and for us at the surface, the decreases that we're seeing in the ozone layer now are quite small. They seem to be persistent, they seem to be robust, but they're much smaller than what was happening before. And at the moment, the decreases are being roughly balanced by tropospheric ozone increases from what we infer from our study. And this is also not a good trade-off because tropospheric ozone, as I said earlier, is bad for our health. So if these trends continue into the future in stratospheric ozone, then it may become a more serious problem that we need to be concerned about. But I think for now, the key is that scientists get on and understand what is going on here and why this is happening.
Will Ball, do you foresee any technical intervention, any geoengineering that might restore the ozone shield if it continues to decline?
Well, I would say for terms of geoengineering, again, in terms of the total ozone layer protecting us, the Montreal Protocol has worked. So a lack of kind of implementation, removing these CFCs has been the most effective way to do it. I would certainly caution against considering geoengineering as a way to deal with these kind of large-scale issues until we actually know what is going on. And even then, we should consider very seriously going down that kind of a road. At the moment, this is not a rapid and something that we should be panicking about, so we definitely shouldn't consider jumping to very, very potentially drastic and unforeseen consequences as a result of applying them at this stage, and probably certainly not until we have any idea of something potentially catastrophic going on that would require such an intervention.
What do we need to find out? What are the next steps to solve the mystery of why our ozone shield has continued to weaken, even if only slightly, despite our best efforts?
I think at the moment, the thing that really needs to happen is that the scientific community now has several avenues that it would need to sort of go down and investigate. So very roughly, I would say that, first of all, it is certainly worth going back to the data and to understand the uncertainties in the data itself, in how these merged products were made. I mean, even the work that we've done to try and account for problems in the data, there's much more that can be done on that. There's also uncertainties in how we attribute or identify the long-term changes in the statistical analysis itself. And this is something that a lot of researchers are also actively engaged in addressing at the moment. Now, in terms of the hypotheses, these are things that should be addressed because despite the issues with time series analysis, statistics, and the data, the real implications from our result are quite clear that this is highly likely to be a real trend that we've detected in the atmosphere. So addressing the hypotheses that it could be very short-lived substances, that should be taken from direction of both modeling studies to, if, for example, we didn't put the right boundary conditions, as in the right emissions into our models. Not that our models are not doing a good job in simulating changes. It's just that we didn't tell it what the right inputs were. It's like if we didn't put the right CO2 emissions into a climate model and then we didn't see the temperature response, that was because we didn't set the model up right. So that was something to look at. The other idea would be then, because we see these elevated, very short-lived substances in the atmosphere, it might be prudent to start to look at the emissions of these more thoroughly and build better inventories and to see what's up in the stratosphere. But the other aspect that needs to be investigated is the potential that this is really now connected. These changes we're seeing in the lower stratosphere are now connected to changes in the climate, because we know that the stratospheric circulation pattern should be modified by the increasing temperatures in near the surface due to dynamical changes. And it's possible that our models are struggling in that specific region, because we know that they do very well in other parts of the climate system. But they might be struggling in that particular region for a number of reasons, and that the modeling community will probably want to investigate this aspect of climate models as well to see if the decrease in ozone is related to this aspect. So there's multiple fronts upon which we can take. And I would also suggest that it would be very prudent that we continue to take observations, that we continue to maintain our observing network. Because at the moment, funding seems to be being restricted all around the world for the less exciting science, in some sense, of just continuing to monitor what's going on with the ozone layer, because the Montreal Protocol has been so effective already. And I think it's prudent that we continue to fund these observations to make sure that we keep an eye on what's going on with the ozone layer, despite the Montreal Protocol's success.
By all means, let's keep watching it, because so much of our life depends upon it. And we have been discussing the paper, Evidence for a Continuous Decline in Lower Stratospheric Ozone, Offsetting Ozone Layer Recovery. And it was published February 6, 2018, in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. Find links to the lead author, Dr. William Ball, the science and the issues in my show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Will, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Scientists warn we are in the sixth great mass extinction event here on Earth, but it doesn't look like it to the average person. What if extinction is not a sudden event like we see in the movies, like an asteroid hit, but it's a long, slow decline? A new theory suggests that was the pattern about 251 million years ago, when up to three-quarters of all land species went extinct. They disappeared. Earth deforested on a global scale, and a depleted ozone layer may have been a surprise driving force. This shatters our assumptions about how extinction works. The new paper was just published February 2018 in Science Advances. The title is UVB-Induced Forest Sterility: Implications of Ozone Shield Failure in Earth's Largest Extinction. The lead author is a rising star in ancient botany, PhD candidate and researcher Jeff P. Benka. He's from the Loy Lab at the University of California in Berkeley. Jeff Benka, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
When you came to Berkeley from the University of Washington, what did you bring with you?
So when I came from University of Washington, I gained a background in studying ecosystems from a fisheries ecology perspective and in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. And there I met a few people who actually were working with ultraviolet B radiation associated with ozone weakening. And I also then worked with a number of folks in paleobotany in the lab of Dr. Caroline Stromberg and the lab of mass extinction paleobiologist Dr. Peter Ward. And during those years, I really started getting an idea of, there's a lot of interesting sorts of connections between what modern ecologists are looking at in biology today and maybe what we could learn about the distant past.
We've had Dr. Peter Ward on the show, I think it's three times. I love his work. In this new paper, you say an unanticipated result tipped you into a new adventure in science. What happened?
When we went into this research, we were interested in figuring out how pollen grains in the fossil record, why they might look malformed. And one of the ideas is that maybe there was ozone weakening going on in the past. And so we decided to design an experiment to test this idea or this hypothesis on modern lineages of plants that were produced very similar pollen to the lineages affected 250 million years ago during the end Permian extinction. And while we went into the study expecting to possibly see these malformed pollen grains as sort of a fingerprint of environmental stress, we were really taken aback and surprised by the observation that the trees in our chamber experiment actually had all of their seed cones die prematurely. So their seed cones died before fertilization. And that really got us thinking about a different way in which this extinction may have played out for ecosystems.
So the trees didn't die, but their reproductive cones did.
Exactly. So in pine trees, there are two different types of cones that are produced. You may all be familiar with seeing the products of one of these cones, pollen cones. Each year, you might get a dusting of yellow pollen at certain times, and that's oftentimes from very large pollen grains of pines and their relatives. The second type of cone is a seed cone, and that's often what we term these big woody pine cones. And it was those seed cones, the pine cones, that we were seeing that were dying before they were able to receive sperm from pollen grains during fertilization.
We know that ultraviolet rays coming from the sun can be really harmful to human eyes and skin, and scientists break down those rays into three basic types that I'm aware of, A, B, and C. Why do you focus on UVB?
We were focusing on UVB because this is one of the most biologically relevant wavelengths. It's a short wavelength that often causes mutations in DNA. So we here on Earth get exposed to both ultraviolet A or UVA and UVB radiation. But a lot of times the UVB is what biologists are most concerned with in terms of mutation.
So we need to enter this time machine. Your paper looks at the worst mass extinction event on the planet. How do we even know the Permian-Triassic extinction happened?
The Permian-Triassic extinction was a major event in geological history, and it really came together as an observation of the disappearance of very large percentages of fossilized life forms. So predominantly we're talking about marine ecosystems. So a lot of times marine or oceanic sediments are where much of the fossil preservation takes place in the world. I mean, that's where we get at least some of the most complete records of what's going on over time. And in marine sediments, we see these just massive disappearances of animals, say, with hard shells that readily fossilize. It's almost sort of a sudden event. They're there, and then they're gone when you're looking up basically a rock section. And for a long time, paleontologists have been puzzled about why this difference in animal diversity between the end of the Permian period and the early Triassic period. And there have been many, many different sorts of ideas for how these oceanic extinctions happened. And actually, your former guest, Peter Ward, does a lot of research on this and has found some very interesting things. And in our case, we actually are trying to figure out what's going on land. It's a very different system than the ocean. There's different forces probably at play. And in land, we see as these marine species disappear, we actually see a very interesting change in land plants. My advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, here at UC Berkeley, during her dissertation years ago, working with her former advisor, Dr. Hank Visser, they found that in marine sediments of Greenland, that pollen assemblages that were deposited right in the same sediments that we see this change in shelly faunas or animal assemblages, there is this sort of pulsed change in the vegetation going on. And they published this noting that there seemed to be this disappearance of woody seed plants. So there were these diverse conifer and what we call gymnosperm-dominated plant groups that really started to dwindle during several points. But the really weird thing is that they didn't just go extinct like the animals did. The plants actually persisted, and they actually lived long enough to basically recover and then get hit again by something. So there was this repeated deforestation sort of pulsed change in the forest community that was going on, and we see the same sorts of plant lineages moving out of the system over and over again until eventually, much further down the line, some of these lineages, for instance, many of the conifer lineages, didn't make it, and only a few were able to survive the actual full crisis.
Now, what are the Siberian traps, and how do they fit into the accepted story of this mass extinction?
So the Siberian traps are what we call a large igneous province. It's a very massive area that was formed by volcanic activity that spans much of northern Russia today. And the Siberian traps were really pertinent for the end-Permian extinction because they basically formed at the same time as this extinction happened. And there's been a number of recent studies that have been looking to date the lava flows and the lava deposits of this volcanic province to figure out just how that timing lines up with the extinction. And recent years, it's been found that some of these eruptive sort of intervals probably lined up very closely, more or less, give a few, you know, tens of thousands of years, which is very short, geologically speaking. And the eruption ceased about, we think, maybe about 500,000 years into the early Triassic period. So it's somewhere from tens of thousands to a million years of volcanic activity that was going on across a very large area of what is now Russia. And this sort of volcanic province has been tied to, or at least has been proposed to be tied to, many of the phenomena we see in the animal records. Scientists propose that many, many different sort of environmental impacts that volcanoes can have on the environment may have really pushed life past its tipping point. For instance, these volcanoes likely produced loads of methane and carbon dioxide, well-known greenhouse gases today, that would have probably accelerated and pushed Earth into these sort of hothouse worlds, basically like these extreme global warming episodes that are sort of our doomsday calculations for the future. And that's one thing, on the one hand, that has really been proposed as driving a lot of these environmental changes, among many others. There's also heavy metals, acid rain, that have been proposed to have wreaked havoc on land. One of the problems, though, with some of these hypotheses is that we don't really know how we can explain the plant dynamics using them. So in many cases, the acid rain sort of idea is quite interesting and quite pertinent to what we've seen in recent years with industrial pollution. But the problem with that idea is that acid rain is a localized phenomenon, roughly speaking. So the Siberian traps were actually erupting up in what is now, or what would have been, the Arctic at that time. And so a lot of these sorts of extremely stressful conditions would have been going on in the northern hemisphere. They wouldn't have reached down to the southern hemisphere to the same extent. And that's where we also see forest collapses.
With the volcanic activity, a lot of it over thousands of years, how does that impact the ozone and therefore the UVB rays that you were studying?
My advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, and her former advisor, Dr. Hank Visser, discovered that across the world during this mass extinction, there is this proliferation of what look like abnormal spores. Particularly, they're spores that are clustered in groups of fours called tetrads. And they were produced by a lineage of plants called lycophytes today. They're represented today by modern club mosses, quillworts, and spike mosses that you can find, say, if you go hiking in the mountains in North America or elsewhere. Now, the thing that was interesting about these spores and that really tipped them off that something might be going on is that it seems that these spores were unseparated during the process of meiosis, the process of basically spore production. And this would suggest that something was disrupting the reproductive process of plants worldwide. These spores were all over the world where you looked, and there were many of them. So they proposed an idea that Siberian traps might have been causing massive destruction to the ozone layer. And this idea came out of similar ideas with the Siberian trap generating gases that could cause atmospheric degradation or pollution. similar to industrial pollution today. That study was published in 2004, and about 5 years later, in 2009, a team of scientists led by Dr. Henrik Svensson found that volcanic sediments that formed around basically eruptive pipes of the Siberian Traps, when you take these rock sediments and you stick them in chambers and heat them, they release massive amounts of methyl chloride, an ozone-depleting compound. These volcanoes actually were erupting possibly in the absolute wrong place at the wrong time. Across Siberia, there were these massive evaporated seaways. We call them halite deposits or salt deposits today. And these salt deposits basically were getting either punctured or heated by these magma conduits. And as the Siberian Traps was forming, this whole gigantic region was having a lot of heating of these salts. And heating of those salts, even passively, can release and unlock methyl chloride and methyl bromide, ozone-depleting compounds that can reach the stratosphere and rip holes in the ozone layer in the Arctic.
Now, just to be clear, when we are looking at CO2 in the past, we can go through, for example, ice cores from Greenland or Antarctica and go back at least 100,000 years and measure little bubbles and find out what the carbon dioxide was. But we don't have any mechanism to directly measure the ozone levels 250 million years ago, do we? Or do we just depend on the way that the impacts are seen?
At the moment, we don't have a direct way of measuring UV radiation in the past. However, there's exciting new research coming out of a team, I believe, that's in England right now, that's led by a researcher by the name of Wesley Fraser. And he and I believe Barry Lomax and a number of other colleagues there have developed a way to look at the chemistry of fossilized pollen and spore walls that actually can be used potentially to figure out the levels of UV radiation that these plants may have been experiencing. So the thought is that plants oftentimes invest sunscreen-like pigments. We call, for instance, one of them is called flavonoids, that they basically put into their spore or pollen walls. It probably helps give a lot of pollen its yellow color if you do see it in conifers. But the amount of that sunscreen that is basically produced by the plant oftentimes has a direct relationship to the amount of radiation the plant receives. So in the coming years, you may well be able to be seeing some studies coming out on the N-Permian from that group. I know they've been really working hard testing this with other systems and more recent sediments, and they've found their results so far are very promising that this, what we call a proxy or an indicator, might actually have some application to the N-Permian.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with my guest Jeff Benka from UC Berkeley. We're talking about damaged ozone and mass extinction. Do we know, Jeff, what the level of ozone is when tree cones begin to become damaged, begin to become less fertile?
So we don't know exactly what the level, the threshold of ultraviolet radiation exposure actually will induce infertility in trees or start seeing a noticeable impact on their inability to produce seeds. More work definitely needs to be done looking at lower UVB levels than what we looked at in our experiment. But what we found in our study was that the lowest UV treatment that we used that was simulating what was modeled through paleoatmospheric and geochemical models was 7.2 times the modern amount of UV radiation that, say, you would get on a really sunny day here in California. Which is enough. You should be putting on sunscreen if you're hanging out outside in the middle of the day in California. These were extremely high radiation levels we were testing for these trees, otherworldly, you would say. But we really don't know because this actually is the first study where anyone has actually looked at the reproductive biology of a non-flowering plant under high UV radiation and whether it impacts that. So we're really just at the tip of the iceberg here. I think that a number of research studies could be done that could really explore how low the increase of UV could be to actually impact our forest health in the world today.
You also talk in the paper, and this goes to your previous discussion about pulses, but you talk about a forest recession episode. Are they prevalent in Earth's past, and why do those happen that way?
So the forest recessions that happen at the end Permian are pretty unique to that event in the pattern that they happen. There definitely are areas where we see an instance of deforestation after the asteroid impact when the dinosaurs went extinct at the Cretaceous Paleogene. And that's sort of a widely cited and mentioned effect of that extinction, is that we see a decline in the forest vegetation in our fossil pollen spore and what we call macrofossil assemblages, so large actual fossils of plants. The really unique thing about the end Permian is that we get this really unique turnover in the vegetation, and it happens over and over and over again. It's strange. And eventually, at the very end of these forest recessions and recovery intervals, we see the disappearance of a number of these lineages. And it almost seems like there just was something that was stressing these communities out, you know, over thousands and thousands of years, that the trees and the plants were resilient. They were survivors, but eventually some of them weren't able to take it after a while. So it really is a testament that something was going on that snuffed out a lot of the animals that the plants were able to tolerate for a very long time.
Do you think some ancient plants had better ways to cope with UVB light, and so maybe they survived with a better competitive advantage?
Yes, we do think that's quite plausible. I mean, these plants are being subjected potentially for tens to hundreds to thousands of years of whatever conditions were present in the Permian world. And with that, there was probably very intense selectivity going on in the ecosystem. So some lineages, some strains, some genetically, there might have been some populations that were more resilient and possibly selected for over time. I mean, when I say selected for, that sounds very deterministic, but they probably had traits that were advantageous for coping with ultraviolet. And one of the lineages of plants that was out there that really was a champion of this extinction is one that my advisor, Dr. Cindy Loy, spent some time studying. And they were these lycophytes, the ones that were forming these weird spore tetrads. We really have no idea what they were doing exactly at this time, but they took over the world. In each one of these deforestation episodes, we see possibly just a handful of genera of these lycophytes just pop up, and they're there. And there's sort of these low-diversity ecosystems dominated by these spore-bearing fern-like plants that really aren't related closely to ferns at all, but do very different things.
If the forests began to die due to infertility from UVB, due to ozone depletion, how do you connect that to the much larger extinction of plants and animals of all kinds that happened around 250 million years ago?
One of the ideas we're having with this extinction is that by disrupting the reproductive capacity of dominant plant lineages around the world, and dominant is really kind of an anthropomorphic term. I mean, these are lineages of plants that seem to be very common and very prevalent in many assemblages we see in the fossil pollen and spore records. But the idea that we have here is that as these forests were unable to replace themselves over time, if you had, say, pulsed ozone weakening from these volcanic outbursts over and over again over thousands of years, we may have seen recession of the forests over generations. And with that, the disappearance of fundamental niches of animals around the world. In a way, we're proposing a different way of looking at extinction and the end Permian in general, in that it is a very dramatic event, and we don't want to downplay that by any means. But the mechanism by which this extinction and possibly other mass extinctions have happened may really have more to do with the role of natural selection over long periods of time under environmental stresses. And it doesn't necessarily require that anything really is starving to death or dying, but that the ecological space and the niche of organisms is changing over thousands of years, and it's changing the number of possibilities that animals, of where an animal can live and how it can function, and we're seeing the disappearance of ecosystems over time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Jeff Benka from UC Berkeley. This is Radio EcoShock. Now, Jeff, we get to a much stronger warning in your paper that we could be underestimating the threat of thinning ozone. Let's start with the picture you give of what would have happened if the Montreal Protocol banning some of these ozone-killing chemicals wasn't in place.
Yes. If the Montreal Protocol didn't pass, we could have really been in deep trouble, not only for our own skin cancer, say, for our species, but also for ecosystems in general based on this study. If the Montreal Protocol didn't pass, we actually, by 2050, might have seen the complete disappearance of the ozone layer in the tropics, which is really alarming and scary. And actually, within the past few days, there's been a new study suggesting that ozone weakening is continuing over at least the tropics, or at least it hasn't really fully healed itself in the way that it has over the Arctic. And we really should still be a little concerned about this and figure out what's causing it. But the other thing that's really alarming about this world-avoided scenario, a previous study done by Newman et al. In 2009 did atmospheric modeling of what the world would look like and its atmosphere would look like by the year, say, 2065. And by that time, we would probably see a 550% increase in DNA-damaging UV radiation in the mid-latitudes, so where a lot of people live here in North America and also in the Southern Hemisphere, too. And with that, we may have seen, much of the world's land surface is covered by coniferous forests. So the coniferous taiga is one of the largest biomes on land today. And what's particularly concerning about this experiment is that though it was done on only a single species of cultivated conifer, it really was a dramatic result that we got. Every single one of these trees was sterilized under all of our increased UV scenarios, and they used the exact same mode of reproduction that a wide range of the conifers dominating the taiga today do. So if we didn't curb these CFCs and ozone depletant pollutants, we might have seen recession over time and possibly disappearance of forests that we rely upon for shelter, timber, but also for our ecosystems in general. And that's a really scary thought.
And you warn we must not slack off on restrictions on chemicals that can damage the ozone layer. Is anybody suggesting that?
We do suggest that. And as far as I know, I haven't necessarily seen direct proposals to curtail ozone or basically the CFCs or any ozone-depleting pollutants. But I think that one of the big issues now is that politically we're in a time where there are economic incentives sometimes that are short-term to lessen or curtail restrictions on environmental pollutants. And we're seeing that here in the United States at the moment, which is a concern to a lot of researchers. But the ozone problem is really, really a long-term issue, too. It's got some parallels to climate change and CO2 and methane emissions. But one of the things that's still really of concern for this is that there are newer chemicals that we are producing that we don't always know all of the environmental effects down the road of when they get in the atmosphere. So some environmental pollutants that are still out there still are able to damage ozone, stratospheric ozone, to some extent. So we need to just make sure that we are really doing rigorous study on these environmental pollutants and continuing to do so, so that we avoid possibly reintroducing a new problem inadvertently.
Jeff, your new paper suggests a new way of looking at mass extinction and the risk of ozone depletion. It is new science. Would you call this a theory, a postulate, or what?
Well, it's funny. My co-author, Dr. Ivo Downstay, on this paper has really been very heavily influential in this new, what we call this new view of extinction. And he often says that it's not really new. It's not necessarily new. It also should be an old view of how extinctions are. Really, what we're proposing is, we're a team in a biology department, and it's interesting because being amongst biologists day in and day out, we think about these events possibly a little differently than we would if we were mostly thinking about the geology of the situation. And to modern biologists who study modern ecosystems, I mean, it's incredibly hard to figure out what drivers of ecological change are in the modern world, even if you have all the advanced tools and technologies at your fingertips. So trying to look back 250 million years is really, it's almost unfathomable. But one of the things that we got out of sort of talking to modern biologists and thinking about this is that there are modern systems today that give us an idea of what maybe an extinction world would have looked like. And one of the really, really compelling examples of this is the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And you see all these very gripping film footage, photography that is done in this area where a number of biologists are working. Some of them, I think you've actually even interviewed in the past. But you see that Chernobyl looks like a beautiful, idyllic landscape right now. If you didn't know what had happened there, and you were ignoring, say, the ruins of what was going on there, you'd probably put up a tent and go camping or backpacking there. And you'd see all sorts of wildlife and all sorts of trees, parklands. But there's really more insidious things going on that are unseen. And to a biologist or someone who studies ecosystems, you really have to put together a lot of pieces of information before you see a dramatic sort of impact going on in the ecosystem. And that may play out over tens to thousands of years, and we may not know it. So the view that we see with extinctions in the past is that maybe they weren't these massive die-offs. Maybe it was more insidious, smaller changes that affected the selectivity of certain lineages over time. And over time, you have the disappearance of lineages. Dr. Downstay really argues in many cases that we really should think of mass extinctions as the termination of lineages on the tree of life. It's not necessarily that everything drops dead. It's that evolutionary lineages disappear over geologic time at a faster rate than newer lineages or newer branches to the tree of life can sprout.
Yes, you conclude in the discussion part of your paper, environmental disasters in the past and present, for example, current anthropogenic climate change, are therefore not always easily perceived as they unfold. That's kind of a scary thought, that we could be blindly walking into a slow-moving environmental disaster right now and not know it.
Absolutely.
We've been talking about paradigm-busting new science. In my opinion, the paper is UVB-induced forced sterility, implications of ozone shield failure in Earth's largest extinction. Our guest is Jeff Benka from the UC Museum of Paleontology and the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of California in Berkeley. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jeff, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's all the time we have, at least for this week. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Arrest was because they wanted to use this case as a deterrent for other Palestinians to act as I did and resist occupation the way she has done.
This is another example, the successes of the Love I Have campaign, that BDS works.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Friedman, you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. In late December, human rights activists in New York City celebrated the closure of the diamond store of Israeli billionaire and settlement profiteer Lev Levayev after 10 years of sustained protest. Activism group Adala New York, which has been at the forefront of the Levayev protests, stated in a press release that, quote, the store closure comes as Jonah Reichnitz, a former employee at Levayev's company Africa Israel USA, testified in a Manhattan court as part of a far-reaching bribery trial that in 2008, Levayev's diamond store attempted to pay off New York City police to quash Adala New York's protests outside Levayev's store. Reichnitz testified that protesters over the holidays, Valentine's Day, and other holidays at Levayev's Madison Avenue diamond store, quote, were a big headache for him. So Reichnitz secured from the jewelry store a further donation for the NYPD football team of $25,000 in order to, quote, make sure the problem went away. Joining us to talk about the significant victory for human rights and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in New York City is Patrick Connors of Adala New York. Pat, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks, Nora. It's great to be here.
So let's talk about this Lev Levayev Diamond Empire and why it's so significant that a group of human rights activists were able to be such a thorn in the side of Levayev companies to the extent that Levayev tried to bribe New York City Police Department to quell the protests. Tell us about the Levayev companies here, including Africa Israel and Leader Management and Development. Who they are, what they do, how they're involved in Israel's illegal settlement colony enterprise, as well as brutal human rights abuses in Angola. What is the Levayev Empire?
Levayev groups all his companies under what he calls the Levayev Group of Companies, and those businesses range from construction to real estate to diamonds to other kind of different exploitative businesses around the world. And then focusing specifically on those involved in settlement construction first, Africa Israel is his flagship real estate construction company, and Africa Israel has been involved in building settlements since at least 2000, all around the West Bank. So Africa Israel has done a lot of the settlement construction that Levayev has been directly involved in. But he also owns a smaller company with his brother-in-law called Leader Management and Development. And Leader Management and Development owns and operates the Zuhaim settlement, which is built on the land of the village of Jayus and some other neighboring West Bank communities. So those are two of his main kind of settlement building enterprises. Additionally, he's donated to different settlement at least one settlement organization and probably more that are involved in expropriating land from Palestinians and then taking it over and building settlements on them. So that's the settlement side. And then just so many of the other elements of Levayev's businesses are involved in human rights abuses and other unethical business practices, as you said, from Leviev Diamonds operations in Angola, where they work closely with the repressive Angolan government, extracting diamonds from communities that don't benefit in any way from the huge wealth that's generated by the diamond industry in Angola. In fact, people are kicked off their land, kind of the way Palestinians are kicked off their land for settlement construction. They're impoverished by the diamond industry. So that's diamonds in Angola. And then in Namibia, he's also been involved in the diamond industry, again, exploiting workers involved in cutting and polishing diamonds. Most everywhere you turn, there's some kind of exploitative business practice throughout different parts of his empire.
Pat, can you talk about the 10 years of protests? What kinds of strategies and tactics did Adela in New York use, and why were they so effective?
Well, we actually started the campaign based on the request of Palestinian and Israeli activists who, along with us, recognized that Leviev was both involved in leading the settlement construction on Jeyus's land, where we had particular, many of us had spent time in Jeyus. And his company was also helping to build the settlement of Matityahu East on the land of Belin, which 10 years ago, you know, was just starting to be built. So talking with Palestinian Israeli activists, we realized that Leviev was involved in settlement construction in key areas. That led us to consider the campaign, particularly because Leviev at that time was just opening his diamond store in New York City and had just made major real estate purchases in New York City, including the old New York Times building, something called the Apthorpe Apartments, and a number of other kind of major buildings in New York City. So he was taking a major presence in New York City where we were based, and he was involved in exploitative settlement construction as well as other business practices, in Palestine and Angola. So he seemed like really his business empire was something to focus on, a good focus for us in New York City. So we started looking at all the different elements of his business, his different partners, nonprofits, governments, celebrities, and really started both protesting at his store as a way to draw attention to the human rights abuses that his companies were involved in, but also reaching out to all of those different business partners progressively and informing them about what Leviev's companies were doing in Palestine, Angola, and even in New York City. And gradually the momentum built as different people, who had some kind of standards for their partnerships, said that we really shouldn't be working with Leviev's companies. One of the first successes was UNICEF that was taking small donations from Leviev, but nonetheless, Leviev's PR firms were talking about them in the media. They cut their relationships with Leviev, said they wouldn't take his money anymore. He was involved in also very indirectly providing money to or support to Oxfam America. Oxfam America couldn't even trace it, but again, Leviev's PR firms were touting that. Eventually, Oxfam America backed away from him. Same thing happened when we contacted a lot of celebrities who were being featured wearing his diamonds. So there was kind of a snowball effect as different actors around the world, either publicly or privately, distanced themselves from Leviev. And more groups around the world became involved in the campaign. Leviev had also opened a store in London. People in London were protesting. Leviev had a store in Dubai. People in Dubai also held some very small protests, but wrote letters, contacted people. And eventually it reached the point where we were able to, in the UK, as momentum built, reach out to the British government, because the British government was about to move its embassy into a Leviev building in Tel Aviv. Once there was a public campaign and pressure put on the British government, they backed out of that deal to move their embassy into a Lviv building in Tel Aviv. And eventually, partners around the world, the BNC, Norwegian civil society groups, Adela New York, and I think WHO Profits reached out to the Norwegian government about the fact that the Norwegian pension fund was invested in Lviv companies. The Norwegian government eventually announced that they would no longer invest in those companies. They divested from those companies. So gradually reaching out to all those different actors, momentum built, different people became involved in the campaign around the world, and it became kind of known that Lviv's businesses were involved in unethical practices, albeit settlements in the diamond industry, et cetera, and people began to sever ties or quietly not initiate them.
What can other activism groups facing off against similar corporations profiting from Israel's ongoing colonization and occupation of Palestine, what can they learn from the Lviv protests? What advice do you have for activists?
Yes, one part of that I didn't mention in talking about how we reached out and worked with people around the world is that, you know, the protests themselves that we held at the Lviv store were generally fun and creative, and we enjoyed putting them together with creative parody songs of holiday carols every Christmas and Hanukkah season at the Lviv store, on Valentine's Day and Mother's Day, and we did little parody skits. So we had fun putting them together, and then we tried to also share that also with people around the world via videos, press releases, photos of, you know, these creative protests. So that was also a key part, was the creative aspect to the on-street protests were fun and exciting and created interest and caught the attention sometimes of media and other people as well. And then the creative protests, street protests, were coupled with this kind of systematic look at the different elements of the Lviv business empire around the world and the different partners and associates that were most vulnerable to because of his unethical business practices, and most likely to eventually separate themselves from him. And so, you know, we, along with many other partners around the world, tried to look systematically at those different partners to leverage our contacts and be in touch with them and pressure them to separate themselves. So as the creative street protests, the kind of systematic analysis of the business, the reaching out to different people around the world who were interested and able to help as appropriate, whether it was in Norway, whether it was in the UK, whether it was in Dubai, obviously Palestine and Israel as well. Those were all key elements. And again, the fact that it was the initial campaign was rooted in real needs on the ground in communities like Belin and Jayus, and that community members there initially expressed a desire for this campaign and participated in the first couple of years by writing letters, by giving feedback on what was going on. So those were all some of the key things that I think helped to make it successful, and that, you know, we try to think about ourselves as we work on other campaigns as well.
Patrick Connors of Adela, New York. Patrick, is there anything else you want to add about you know, the last decade of protests against Lviv and the significance for you as a member of this activism group who's been so heavily involved in these protests that the store has finally closed?
Yeah, it's exciting for all of us to have been involved in, you know, a successful BDS campaign. And, you know, we feel some degree of satisfaction, the achievements of the campaign. And I think, you know, the first couple of years, there was a lot of month after month successes that kept things going. But we felt you know, the work was not done, and it's still not actually done. So we did kind of persist and continue to pay attention to what was happening with Lavaev, because as I said, the work was not done. Lavaev still, in to some degree, may be involved in settlements. The settlements that he built still exist. He's still an Israeli business that's boycottable. So the persistence is also important, I think, to help ensure long-term achievements. I think what we, you know, see as exciting here is, again, that this is another example, the successes of the Lavaev campaign, that BDS works and is achieving successes around the world, whether it's the Lavaev companies, Veolia, G4S, Church Divestment, artists supporting the boycott, artists not performing in Israel. Obviously, BDS is achieving successes and growing worldwide and is increasingly being seen by the Israeli government as the threat that it really is, because we are working as civil society to hold Israel accountable for its human rights abuses.
Well, Patrick Connors, thank you so much. Again, Patrick Connors of Adala, New York. And what's the best way to get in touch with Adala?
It's info@adalahny.org. So info@adalahny.org.
Great. Patrick Connors, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks a lot, Nora.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakut, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who assesses the partisan conflict triggered by the Nunes memo in what many fear is part of a gathering and dangerous constitutional crisis. Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program, who talks about the disproportionate impact of climate change on women of color, and journalist Stephen Rosenfeld, who discusses the U.S. Supreme Court's important role in ruling on current cases challenging the partisan gerrymandering of congressional district maps. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Returning from a brief trade tour of China, British Prime Minister Theresa May faces a rebellion from members of her Conservative Party over Brexit negotiations with the European Union. A faction of Tory conservatives favors joining up with the opposition Labour Party, who are advocating a new customs union with Europe. Many in the Labour Party want to schedule a second referendum to reconsider a British divorce from the EU. Two leading Tories, including former Chancellor Ken Clark, favor retaining a customs union with the EU, rejecting the position of Eurosceptics who backed Brexit. However, The Guardian newspaper reports that the issue has become a dividing line between supporters of a hard Brexit, who believe it would limit sovereignty and prevent the UK striking deals with non-EU countries, and supporters of a soft Brexit, who want to keep Britain's trading ties with the EU as close as possible. Supporters of a soft Brexit believe Labour's position will be crucial in creating a parliamentary majority for staying in the customs union, which could help solve the dilemma over trade across Ireland's border, which remains in the EU. Among Labour's base, there's increased overall support to remain in the EU, but many Labour supporters in the north of England and Midlands region still favour Brexit. In a sign of the growing influence of high-tech companies, Google spent $18 million last year to influence Congress, federal agencies, and the White House on issues ranging from tax reform, immigration, and net neutrality. According to the Washington Post, Google also weighed in on attempts to regulate online advertising, its core profit center. 2017 was the first year a tech company outspent other industries, such as energy corporations, the telecom sector, and military contractors, in lobbying Washington. Social media giant Facebook spent $11 million on federal lobbying in 2017, focusing on immigration and net neutrality rules. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Google, Amazon, and Facebook combined nearly $11 million to protect net neutrality rules, while internet service providers like AT&T and Comcast spent the same amount supporting the Trump FCC's move to kill net neutrality. The tech industry's ballooning lobbying budgets may indicate that the companies will fight hard to protect the data they are collecting on Americans, said Alvaro Bedoya, executive director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University. Bedoya worries that the government will find it increasingly difficult to pass new and meaningful consumer protection laws. The expansion of CVS's corporate empire, including its recently announced bid to acquire insurance giant Aetna, is bad news for small locally owned pharmacies. CVS, which is accused of trying to put independent pharmacists out of business, operates a vast chain of pharmacies, and CVS Caremark, the nation's second largest pharmacy benefit manager, which negotiates directly with health plans over coverage and pricing for pharmaceutical drugs. Industry observers say this concentration of power is a disaster for competition and access, particularly in underserved communities. Adding a health insurer like Aetna would further strengthen CVS's control of the pharmaceutical market and narrow the networks people depend on for medical care. According to the American Prospect, CVS has cut reimbursements for prescription drugs, mostly impacting Medicaid-managed care. But a disproportionate share of independent pharmacist incomes comes from such plans. Over 90% of independents' revenue comes from prescription drug sales, unlike full-service chains that feature more consumer products for sale. And over half of those prescriptions are from Medicare Part D and Medicaid. The CVS merger with Aetna will bolster the company's plan to launch a chain of Minute Clinic walk-in centers for minor illnesses and injuries. If the plan goes forward, CVS Aetna can steer patients with its insurance and drug benefits to its own clinics and pharmacies. Doug Hoey, president of the National Community Pharmacists Association, warns that profits for the conglomerate will take precedence over the best interest of the patient. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
For the last few weeks, Washington has been focused on the controversial memo written by Devin Nunes, Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, which described alleged bias against Trump and improprieties by the FBI and Justice Department in the process used to obtain a FISA surveillance warrant targeting Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. While the FBI, Justice Department, former intelligence officials, and most Democrats condemned the decision by the House Intelligence Committee and White House to release the memo due to concerns regarding classified material, most of the information on the 3.5-page document had already been published. Although President Trump erroneously declared that the Nunes memo had vindicated him in allegations that he colluded with Russia to influence the 2016 presidential election, many observers have concluded that the memo, in fact, had backfired. In cherry-picking the information in his memo, Nunes misrepresented important facts and failed to discredit Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Trump-Russia investigation. House Democrats are now waiting for the White House to authorize the release of their own 10-page memo, which is said to refute the Nunes allegations point by point. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst and author who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Here, Goodman assesses the partisan conflict triggered by the Nunes memo in what many fear is part of a gathering and dangerous constitutional crisis.
The observation I have is based on 42 years of security clearances with CIA, the State Department, the Defense Department, the United States Army, for that matter. I've dealt with the military. I've spent time helping to train FBI officers. I've been at the CIA, the Defense Department. These are very conservative individuals who lead these institutions. They are, for the most part, Republicans. They're not Democrats. So the whole notion that somehow there's this deep state that's working within all of these institutions to compromise and even overthrow the president of the United States is really just an absurd notion. As for the Nunes memo itself, this is a very dangerous trend because it furthers the politicization of the intelligence committees on the Hill. And remember, these committees, like the FISA court itself, came out in the mid and late 1970s because of the crimes that were committed by the FBI and the CIA and the National Security Agency under the heading of COINTELPRO. These were the counterintelligence programs that were aimed at Americans who were in the anti-war movement, for example. So there were mail openings, there were illegal surveillance, there were wiretaps without warrants. So in the 1970s, after the Church and Pike Committee hearings, you got the creation of the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees and the creation with the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the creation of the FISA Court, which had to approve any warrant, any surveillance of an American citizen. So with the Nunes memo, and clearly Devin Nunes has demonstrated that he's simply a stooge of the White House, a stooge of President Trump. He's trying to act as Trump's defense lawyer on the Hill. He's doing a pretty miserable job of it. Remember his midnight run to the White House to get documents that he claimed came to him from a secret source. It wasn't a secret source. It was someone in the White House giving him documents that the president's staff had already seen. And with this Nunes memo, you get a very one-sided account of the warrant that was issued to monitor the activities of Carter Page. And that's why the House Intelligence Committee voted, I believe unanimously, to release now the Democratic memo. And this is an unfortunate trend to have these dueling memos, but I think the Democrats had to go ahead and get on record their view of the evidentiary basis that's involved in the Nunes memo, because the Nunes memo is so one-sided and how these warrants were obtained. Now, the point that is really controversial in this memo is that without McCabe giving the Steele dossier to the FISA court, there would have been no FISA warrant. Well, that's a lie. I won't say it's false. It's a lie. The key issue in getting the warrant on Carter Page, who had been in the Trump campaign at some level, really that was the former campaign worker George Papadopoulos, who gave that information to an Australian diplomat, and we're told that the Australian diplomat was so concerned about the information he got from Papadopoulos that he gave this information to the FBI. I'm assuming that the FISA court had good reason to permit this warrant of an American citizen. However, what we've seen since 1978, 1979, when this court was created, and remember, it's a secret court without any way of challenging the court they received thousands of applications over the years, and maybe only a dozen of these applications were ever denied. So it raises certainly the obvious observation that the FISA court, to some degree, has become a rubber stamp for the FBI and the Justice Department. So I think we need to learn more about the FISA court.
Well, Mel, we only have time for one more comment, and I wanted to get your take on this. There's a lot of concern out there about a coming constitutional crisis in the United States where various branches of government will be pitted against one another in this attempt, it appears, by the White House to marshal all its forces to try and discredit the Mueller investigation and put off, for the moment anyway, as they see it, some kind of event that will bring down this presidency. What are your concerns about a constitutional crisis?
Well, I think we're already in a constitutional crisis. You have a president of the United States who is not fit to serve, and he surrounded himself with authoritarian figures, mostly from the military. So the crisis is already there. Well, the problem is I don't think Democrats know what to do about it. They've been in a crisis, frankly, since the Republicans said they weren't going to give Merrick Garland a hearing as a nominee to the Supreme Court. I think really was the signal that the Democrats are in for a real battle, and I don't think they're in a position to wage it with any great strength because they're a diverse coalition to begin with, the way a political party should be, and they're up against this old white man Republican party from another time that I think over the long run is going to fail, but on the short term is going to cause a lot of friction and tension in American political life.
That was Mel Goodman, a former Soviet analyst at the CIA and author, who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Goodman's latest book is titled Whistleblower at the CIA. For more perspectives on the Nunes memo and the Trump-Russia probe, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 145th American Public Health Association Conference drew 12,000 people to their annual gathering in Atlanta, Georgia, for 4 days in early November 2017. The conference theme was climate change and public health, where dozens of workshops, panels, and plenaries were organized to address that topic. One of the conference panels was titled Women and Climate Change, where three women made presentations on various aspects of how climate change impacts women first and worst, both in the U.S. and globally. One of the panel speakers was Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Her talk dealt with the double jeopardy of race and gender that women of color face in human-induced natural disasters, such as hurricanes, droughts, and floods. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the panel discussion and brings us this excerpt of Patterson's talk.
The historical roots of climate change rooted in patriarchy include the rampant extraction and exploitation of both human and natural resources. And then we see it institutionalized in our trade, manufacturing, finance policies that benefit corporations and industrialized nations as opposed to really looking at human rights for all. And so when we talk about some of the impacts of this in terms of frontline communities who are feeling these impacts now, we know that our extraction, whether we're extracting coal, which in the context of mining, 76,000 coal miners have died of black lung disease since 1968, while year after year the National Mining Association fights against the very regulations that would have protected those workers from coal mine dust so that they can continue to maximize profits without any regard to human rights and even human life at all. And so, and even as we make this transition, we talk about transitioning to natural gas, which has its own perils, as we all know, in terms of fracking. And all of these practices disproportionately impact women. And so when we talk about the effects of pollution, air pollution, water pollution, soil contamination, all gets into our bodies through what comes out of the smokestacks, what gets into our waterways through runoff or releases, and then also what gets into our soil, whether it's via acid rain or through runoff or otherwise. And this all impacts our bodies in different ways, and particularly women's bodies as it relates to some of what comes out of smokestacks, particularly coal plants and oil refineries and so forth, include endocrine disruptors, which has an impact on our reproductive systems. And so as we begin to talk about some specifics, because I want to really root us in not just kind of the statistics and the general stories, but also who is being impacted. This is a woman named Annie who lived in North Carolina, and she was recording in her neighborhood. She was doing her own independent health survey where she was going around speaking to her neighbors and then making notations about illnesses that she was finding in her community. And on that notepad, you see the list of names, and next to them you might see a little notation, and those are deeds for people who over time were deceased as she was doing the survey. And when I was doing this presentation 3 months after I met her in North Carolina, when I showed her picture, there was kind of a rumble in the crowd. And then I asked what was going on, and they said that just a couple of weeks before that, she herself had passed away. And she told me when she was talking to me that she was also feeling the health impacts of this exposure to coal ash in her community. And when her husband walked in, she kind of started talking lower because her husband actually worked for the company that ran the coal-fired power plant in the community. So we see how in terms of both the health impacts, physical health impacts, but even relationship and mental health impacts of living in those situations and being a defender of human rights in those contexts. In the aftermath of the disaster that happened around the Flint water crisis, we saw female-headed households who were significantly impacted by not having the mobility to be able to move, being the caretakers for their families, particularly from single women-headed households. And this is one family where it's a family of a woman and three kids, and they're relying on 151 bottles of water per day to just do their daily activities for life. And so there was story after story that was similar in terms of, and again, we talk about the physical burdens as well as the mental health burdens that women face in these contexts. And another situation that we talk about is in the oil extraction process. People may have heard of man camps that happen in North Dakota and South Dakota, where there are camps where people come together for the extraction industry, the oil and gas industry, and it's all men living in those places. What often doesn't get told is the story of the women, largely indigenous women, largely women of color, who are disappeared in those situations and who face sexual assault in those situations often as well. And so this is another piece along the climate change continuum, both the drivers and the impacts that disproportionately impacts women. And so as we talk about the results of climate change, whether it's sea level rise that's displacing folks across, in different places in coastal regions, places like the Pinellas County in Florida, Thibodaux, Louisiana, the Kivalina in Alaska are also facing imminent displacement within 20 years because of sea level rise. And already one community, the Ile de Jean Charles Band of the Biloxi, Chinamaca, Choctaw tribe, was also displaced because of sea level rise. And as we see shifts in agricultural yields, we know that women in the United States and across the world are more likely to be food insecure, and particularly female-headed households are more likely to be food insecure. That actually has a deadly impact because women are facing extreme increases in domestic violence because agriculture is seen as the role of women in some societies, and it is resulting in violence against women that they aren't able to fulfill their roles because of the shifts in agricultural yields.
That was Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Find links to related articles and information on this topic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Democrats gear up for this November's 2018 midterm election, hoping to take over the U.S. House of Representatives and possibly the Senate, the issue of gerrymandered congressional district maps has become an ever more important issue. Back in 2010, Republicans focused their electoral effort on taking over state legislatures from coast to coast, with the prize being the right to redraw congressional district maps based on census data that's gathered every 10 years. The Republicans' Red Map Project, as it was called, was a success. Once the maps were redrawn to provide GOP candidates a partisan advantage, Republicans have had a lock on controlling the House of Representatives. However, in recent years, lawsuits have been filed challenging the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, where Republicans hold 13 of 18 congressional seats due to gerrymandered districts, a lawsuit resulted in the state Supreme Court striking down the congressional map. Republicans appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, but on February 5th, the High Court declined to hear the case. Now the GOP-controlled legislature must draw new maps by February 15th. Your reporter spoke with Stephen Rosenfeld, who covers democracy and voting rights issues for Alternate.org. Here he discusses the challenges to gerrymandering in Pennsylvania and the U.S. Supreme Court's role ruling on other important partisan gerrymandering cases that could determine which party controls Congress.
In 2011, the Republicans in Pennsylvania, like many other states, they just went crazy. They didn't draw maps based on logical things like county lines or school districts or urban centers, so that if you're a member of Congress, you represent a constituency. They went down to the neighborhood and block level using all the information that that people now know is out there. And they basically segregated the voters by party. And as a result, and this is what gerrymandering is about, the Republicans gave themselves districts where they could win with 55, 56, 57% of the vote based on their most reliable voters. And they made sure that the Democrats never reached those numbers. And then they took the Democrats where they were, and they made sure they would win with 65, 70%. So they call it cracking and packing. And over this last decade, there's been a ton of litigation in a lot of states, and it's just been simmering along. And now it's finally worked its way to the state Supreme Courts. And in Pennsylvania, there was a very unusual decision. It didn't involve any federal law whatsoever. And last week, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court told the state legislature, you have to redraw these maps. It violates our state constitution. And, of course, the Republicans said, well, we're going to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to touch it. What that means is that it's supposed to be a fast-track process where the Pennsylvania legislature is supposed to come up with new maps. And if they don't come up with new maps, then the state Supreme Court is going to have an expert, this Stanford law professor, draw the maps. And what we've seen so far, and this is what's been the pattern in every other state in recent years where Republicans have been told to redraw the maps, they're dragging their feet, they're ignoring court deadlines, and they're just trying to drag out the process so that the maps that they drew initially just hold, you know, through the next election. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the next literally couple of weeks, because it looks like the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania is going to step on the Republicans and draw maps because they're not going to do it, they being the Republican legislators.
Summarize for our listeners, what are the important cases that the Supreme Court will hear in the coming months that will determine whether or not we see an end to this extreme partisan gerrymandering?
Well, the biggest case comes out of Wisconsin, and it concerns the state legislature. And there the question is whether they're going to accept this standard based on what they call wasted votes. And it's for the entire legislature, so it's not just a couple of seats. The next one that's big, the Republicans took a case where there was the one example of a Democratic gerrymander. It was in Maryland, and it concerned one congressional seat. It wasn't the entire state delegation. The next ones that come out that are really big are in Texas. There's the use of race to create the congressional districts there, but they're probably not going to issue a decision until late in the spring, which means it won't affect 2018. And the same thing is true with North Carolina, where, again, once again, the Republican legislature was ordered by a federal court to redraw the maps, and they refused, and the Supreme Court said, okay, we'll finally take the case. So that means it freezes it. So those are the big ones. The lower courts in North Carolina said the Republicans went after voters by race with surgical precision. That was their quote. So this is what we're dealing with here.
What are the critical factors you think at play here? And I think you summarized many of them, but if you had to distill it down, what will determine if we're going to have some even playing fields in the future of American politics, or whether we're going to have this rigged system for many years to come? Is it the will of progressive activists? I mean, is it courts? Is it money? What do you think it is?
Well, it's a really great question. I think this gerrymandering thing and map drawing is a really big thing because it's not the elephant in the living room, it's the living room. If the Republicans have a built-in 6-point to 8-point advantage, and these statistics don't just come from me, they come from the best statisticians and academics, that's a very high wall to get over. And then it becomes a question of voter turnout. And the blue states and the red states, they might as well be different countries. It's very hard to get people to register and to turn out and to vote in a lot of these red states. It's not the same as a lot of the blue states. But once again, it comes down to voter turnout on election day and then hoping that the process is transparent enough so if it's close, the ballots can be, can be verified, the vote can be verified. That's all we've got. I've been around, this kind of politics for decades, and this is what it basically comes back down to.
That was Steven Rosenfeld, who covers democracy and voting rights issues for Alternet.org. His forthcoming book is titled Democracy Betrayed. Find more analysis and commentary on the issue of partisan gerrymandering by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KDNK in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Blues for Hugh Masekela. His name was Hugh Masekela. a trumpeteer, South Africa, who played to joyous crowds the world over, a musical exile from the madness of apartheid, the racially exclusive system that ruled that country for decades. Masekela used his music to tell stories of his country and the Africans who lived there. I'm fairly certain that the first time I heard the word shabeen, or a drinking house, was from his lips. His horn was clean, pure, as clear as a bell on a new Sunday morning. His songs were places one could visit Africa, and often he would speak in an African tongue that we did not know. The words, talismans of black African magic that bewitched the youth of the 60s. Words without meaning could and did mean everything and nothing at the same time. I once interviewed Masekela in the back rooms of a club in downtown Philadelphia called Just Jazz.
You've been doing what you've been doing for quite a long time. By that I mean your music, you know, for quite a long time here in the States. And there were people who remember your Grazing in the Grass days of the late 60s and what that meant to black people who were young and needed to hear different forms of music coming from black people in other parts of the world. How have you seen yourself as a musician?
I think of myself more as a very grateful person. I'm grateful, you know, to God that I have the gift that I have. I look at it as a very spiritual thing. I give it a lot of respect, and I play with musicians who are very respectful of the art. You know, I have a great reverence for it. So I don't really have what you would call a very complicated vision of it. You know, I don't think of myself as a cultist figure. I don't think of myself as a person with a mysterious situation, you know. I think myself mostly like as a part of the international black community that is my inspiration.
In that interview, I asked him how it felt to see black folks in Philadelphia in the U.S. He drew a long toke from a joint and said, "It's all Africa, man. I go to Philly, New York, the Caribbean, Puerto Rico, Brazil, everywhere I go, man. Everywhere. It's all Africa." You, Masekela, master musician, giving the world the sounds of Africa, has returned to his ancestors from a prison nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Lawyer. When we fight, we win.
Well, on the night of April 23rd, 2000, I didn't kill anyone. I did not kill anyone. But I was at Grandma Burger's that night, and I was there just like everybody else, 200 people coming and going, speaking to people that I know. And based upon my interactions and my conversations, individuals must have reported to the Syracuse Police Department, "Hey, Derek Wilson was out there." And once they heard that, it was just like, oh, he's a criminal. He's a bad guy. And It was just 18 months prior to that. Was it 18 months, 16 months prior to that that I had filed the lawsuit against the Syracuse Police Department? I don't know who killed Waleed Cameron, and I'm pretty sure the police don't know either because they failed to conduct an investigation. But you can believe in Syracuse, New York, if I would have killed Waleed Cameron in front of 200 people, you would have had about 20 witnesses up there saying that they seen me do this. See, there's no positive identifications. You got a guy, Jamel Harris, changing the story over and over again. You weren't going to bring the case. Now, when you have a lawyer that's overburdened, a lot of these lawyers, I'm not saying that they're selling you out because there's collusion with the lawyer in the DA's office. Maybe that does happen. I'm not counting that out either, but I'm not claiming or clamoring that that's the norm. It's more so that these lawyers are overburdened. Unfortunately, I haven't heard anything from the victim's family. In regards to the victim's family, that's a loss that you can never have back. So I can understand the bereavement. I can understand the grief. And I would just tell you that I did not commit this crime. And I feel your pain, and I provide you my condolences. And it's unfortunately, the Syracuse Police Department did not investigate this crime so that the perpetrator of this crime could actually be held accountable for their actions. At the moment, I feel triumphant. I feel victorious, vindicated to a degree, but I know that I'm not free. You should not have to choose between self-representation and incompetent counsel, not because he can't do his job, but because he's not prepared. For me to prepare for this trial, my preparation was constant, diligent, day in and day out. At the moment, I've been incarcerated for 3.5 years. So my preparation for this trial began 2 years ago when I was arrested on October 22nd, 2015 for this homicide that I did not commit. In the facility that I'm currently at, we have a law library kiosk, and 8 hours, 9 hours out of the day, I'm on the kiosk. And then when I'm in my cell, I call my cell my office. And when I'm in my cell or my office, I'm working, I'm preparing motions, I'm reviewing the facts of the case, and you just have to immerse yourself. I would have boxes up against the wall, boxes under the bed, boxes underneath the desk, and this is underneath the desk. These are boxes of paper. In the federal case, there was 11 boxes that I was provided. In the state case that I was fighting, there was about 6 boxes. So I had all of these boxes to the point where it was like significantly could be considered a fire hazard. I began to study the law. And prior to me coming into this proceeding, I studied the law for about 10 years straight, diligently. And I began to take an affinity for the law. I like to walk. So I'm walking in this big rectangle around the edges of the parameters of the pod, and I'm talking to myself. But I'm not really talking to myself. I'm reciting the information. My certain line of cross-examination, and it's intensive. I do it all day. I believe in perfection. I believe in perfection. So as long as you put hard work, you can perfect your craft. Another individual that's in a situation where he's accused of a crime, how can he learn from my success? The first thing that I would advise is do not think that you can just go in there and wing it. I would not advise you to represent yourself. This was a calculated decision by me, and I knew that I was prepared. Everyone that I encountered tried to discourage me from representing myself. And it's understandable. This is a profession where you have to go to college for years so that you can perfect your craft. And my mother, she was so nervous. She's already the type of individual that my problems are her problems. The lawyers that I was firing, they were trying to discourage me. Hey, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't represent yourself. I agree. I shouldn't have had to represent myself. I should not have had to represent myself. But I am a man of principle. I am a man of principle. And there is no way that I'm going to sit in a trial and allow for a lawyer to represent me and their representation falls below the standard that the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution guarantees. I did that before, and I received a 21 years to life sentence for a crime that I did not commit.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. On today's program, we review the life and legacy of independent investigative journalist Robert Perry. On Saturday, January 27, 2018, a journalist with an impressive body of work to his credit passed away. Robert Perry was born in Hartford, Connecticut. He attended Colby College in Waterville, Maine in the late 1960s and received his BA in English in 1971. He had joined the Associated Press in 1974 and moved to the Washington, D.C. Bureau 3 years later. He's probably best known for his work along with colleague Brian Barger exposing the selling of arms to revolutionary forces in Iran and the directing of the profits to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, a scheme which would come to be known as the Iran-Contra affair. It was Robert Perry who managed to unlock a trove of documents that conclusively proved that the Reagan campaign had interfered with the negotiations to free American hostages in 1980. Perry had commented that he was scorned for pursuing stories that went against the grain of official Washington, compromising a very promising career in mainstream journalism to pursue his calling as an investigative journalist in the truest sense of that term. He ended up founding an online site called ConsortiumNews.com in 1995, where he would continue digging deeper on Iran-Contra and the misdemeanors of the Reagan-Bush era. Robert Perry's work on Iran-Contra had made him a finalist for the 1985 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting and earned him the George Polk Award for National Reporting in 1984. 2 decades later, he would receive the I.F. Stone Medal for Journalistic Independence by Harvard's Nieman Foundation for Journalism, an award named after one of his early influences. In June of last year, Perry received the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, named after the fearless war correspondent. This award goes to a journalist whose work has penetrated the established version of events and told an unpalatable truth, a truth validated by powerful facts that expose what Martha Gellhorn called official drivel. The legendary investigative journalist and filmmaker John Pilger had presented the award to Perry in London last year. The Global Research News Hour asked him to offer his thoughts about Perry's body of work and legacy. John Pilger, what does Mr. Perry's death mean for the future of investigative journalism?
Well, it's a huge loss because Bob Perry was, as Seymour Hersh described him, a trailblazer for independent journalism. But Hersh also added he was a trailblazer who, by blazing trails, burned bridges with the media establishment from which I suppose he came. He'd worked for the Associated Press, Newsweek, and so on. But Bob Perry tackled that head on and established really as a pioneer in, I think, 95 or 96, well over 20 years ago, a website called the Consortium News. Consortium News has since distinguished itself as a source of independent news, of factual news, of analysis, much of it run by Bob himself, by his sons in the beginning, and now it's been taken over by his son, Matt Perry. But that was almost a shining example of this independent journalism, which is almost now by definition excluded from the mainstream, having a place to go, having a home, and Bob provided that home. His own example was extraordinary. He he was largely responsible for revealing the Iran-Contra scandal. He was responsible for revealing the so-called October surprise that provided a great deal of evidence that the Reagan campaign had conspired with Iran to hold the release of U.S. hostages until after the U.S. election, and so not give then President Carter any electoral advantage. He exposed President Nixon's secret deal with the puppet regime in Saigon to scupper the peace talks, which in the 1970s were going on with Hanoi, and much else. So his own example as a journalist who challenged government and its vested interests, who questioned, who was skeptical about power, and especially unaccountable power. His own example really kept going through this extraordinary website, Consortium News, that he began in the 1990s. I wrote for it. Many others wrote for it. Ray McGovern, some extremely interesting, analytical, and journalists and commentators countering what I would call the accredited view and challenging that accredited view, that establishment received wisdom, is what Bob Parry devoted his life to, and we miss him very much for that reason.
I was wondering if you could comment on that accredited view point that one dare not deviate from. You did mention that there was maybe a golden age of sorts where there was a generation ago a space for dissenting journalism like the kind you practice, and it's closed up today, or all but closed up. What is your understanding of that that corrosion of free inquiry we've seen over the last few decades, basically...
I'm not sure I use the term golden age. I suppose by comparison, a golden age did exist by comparison with today. I think what I have said is that space opened in some of the mainstream media for independent journalism, for what is called today dissenting journalism. I mean, I'm one of those dissenters, and I never regarded myself as a dissenter. It's got so bad these days, you don't even regard yourself as a dissenter, you regard yourself as a dissident, I think. But in those days, let's say the 1960s and 70s, I suppose reflecting the enormous political and cultural and social changes that were being developed during that period. It was boom years in economic terms, and it was boom years in terms of ideas and of challenging the status quo, challenging that accredited view, that received wisdom. And the difference between today, the so-called information age, and going back some years, is that people could then open a newspaper or a magazine and find journalism that would differ greatly from the what I would call, as I say, the accredited view.
I was wondering if you might have, if there's an anecdote, a specific memory that you might have of Mr. Perry that will sort of linger with you after his death.
What interested me very much was that he was a defender of Gary Webb. Gary Webb was a journalist who disclosed CIA involvement in the cocaine trade from Latin America into Los Angeles. And this had a devastating impact on the African-American population in Los Angeles. His articles, which were published in the Sacramento paper, were called Dark Alliance. What was interesting about Gary Webb is that although these were powerful articles, which I have to say very quickly, were later vindicated even by an internal report by the Inspector General of the CIA. They were vindicated as true. They were attacked by mostly the liberal media, the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and Bob Perry was, because he'd worked on similar stories, knew Gary Webb and understood just how important and how revealing his stories were. And I was very interested in what had happened to Gary Webb, because it really set the attacks on Webb, and I have to say Webb ended up taking his own life in his late 40s. His life collapsed. But undoubtedly, the campaign against him contributed to that. It seems to me there's a parallel there with the attacks on Julian Assange. And one asks why. Is it because journalism that really reveals, shines a light into the darkest recesses of a system, that kind of investigative journalism, that kind of whistleblowing, is it because it shames so much of mainstream journalism? I'm not absolutely sure, but I think that has something to do with it. Bob Parry, so my early memories of Bob Parry, that's not the answer to your question, I'm afraid. Let me give you an anecdote. Last year, I presented Bob Parry with the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism in London. I'm chair of the judges panel, and this is quite a prestigious award. It's given to journalism published anywhere in the English language. There's a lot of competition, many entries. Bob Parry was, I think, in the 17 years I've been judging the prize, one of the most complete winners of this award. And we use Martha Gellhorn's own words that the award is given to a journalist who challenges, as Martha Gellhorn put it, the official drivel of power, of unaccountable power. Bob Parry did that. But what was interesting at the dinner in London, I presented Bob with the award and sat down expecting him to stand up and say just a few words of thank you. And he instead gave us what must have been, I suppose, 50 minutes of the most spellbinding analysis of American politics and American exceptionalism going right back to Jefferson and beyond. I hadn't heard this from a journalist. I hadn't heard it at all from a journalist spoken in this way, so articulate, so fluent, so powerful, all spoken off the cuff. It was an extraordinary, it's wrong to say performance, it was just, it was so erudite and so eloquent that it really told us that this was a very special journalist.
That was investigative journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. Consortium News, established in 1995, became the main focus for Bob Perry's journalistic endeavors. The alternative news outlet broke ground on a range of stories which mainstream media would not touch, ranging from the Reagan campaign's interference with President Carter's negotiations for the release of hostages in Iran, to dissenting views on the case for war with Iraq in 2003, and more currently, the documentation of U.S. involvement in a coup in Ukraine in 2014, the deconstruction of the argument of Syrian President Assad's use of chemical weapons on his own people, and the debunking of the claim of evidence of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. The consortium has attracted a number of promising writers and analysts to the fold. One of these is Ray McGovern. He served as an Army and CIA intelligence analyst for 30 years and chaired national intelligence estimates through the 1980s. He is co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which is still featured on the Consortium News website. A past guest of the Global Research NewsHour, Ray spoke about his remembrances of Robert Perry and the legacy he left behind.
Well, I had been one of those who set up Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and Bob and others who wanted to follow what we were doing, what we were analyzing, was familiar with us. I met him at a birthday celebration for Dave McMichael, an old sturdy hand at this, and Bob said, you know, I'd really like to write for Consortium News. And just at about that time, I had stopped writing for TomPaine.com and for TruthOut.com. So it was real natural. And Bob says, you know, we pay our writers. I said, oh, you do? That was something about Bob. He was very, very insistent that if you write original stuff, you should be paid for it. Hasten to add, it wasn't very much. But yeah, it's a token of how Bob felt writers should be treated.
Your understanding of his, you know, in terms of his journalistic approach and the kind of pushback he seemed to be getting from not just the, you know, official political circles, but also from fellow journalists. Did he guide you in any way in terms of how to confront that, you know, being sort of on the outside there at Consortium News?
You know, well, Bob was he was really hurt. I mean, he was kind of first appalled, and then he was appalled at what had happened to his profession. He loved the profession of journalism. He was really good at it. He did honest journalism, and all of a sudden there became no market for that. Not only that, but people tried to kind of enroll him in all kinds of politicized analysis, which was beyond his ken, that some good people would participate in this stuff, you know, Russiagate, for example. And he took all kinds of hits for this. And, you know, I think that that had something to do with his health, because he said to me one time, he said, you know, Ray, you're different. He says, you have this thin skill. You almost enjoy this kind of stuff when people match you, don't you? And he said, yeah, I'm Irish, Bob, and yeah, I don't. He says, well, please know that I'm different. It hurts. I don't like when nastiness happens. And so were I to contrast myself with Bob, I would say, in all honesty, that he had a kindness that I lack, a professional kindness, right? You know, somebody comes at me
And my natural reaction is to professionally respond, but with vigor and with almost some enjoyment. Bob didn't like that. Bob tried to avoid that. And I watched him navigate all this because people were really, really scurrilous the way they call him a poutine puppet and all this kind of stuff. So I learned that from Bob. I learned that he's supposed to be kind as well as well as belligerent when the occasion calls for us. But I also learned that some people don't have the thick skin that I have, and you know, wonder of wonders, don't enjoy this kind of thing when people come at you. So, you know, let me just share one vignette that speaks volumes about Bob's predicament. So he's a hero, a Polk Award. He wins. He's justifiably praised for his uncovering Iran-Contra, naming Ali Norris. So, you know, he's riding high, so high that the AP says, yeah, go ahead, go to Newsweek, be a star. Okay, so he goes to Newsweek, and he starts to encounter some problems and telling it like it is, you know. And in the midst of that, the head of Newsweek said, hey, Bob, we're having a soiree at the, you know, the big boss's house, and people coming down from corporate in New York, and so, like you to come, it'll only be about 12 of us, and so the boss says, of course, you know. So he's sitting there, and who's there? Well, the establishment there is a fellow from Wyoming, what was his name? Cheney was his name, yeah, Dick Cheney, a young congressman from Wyoming. We're talking mid-80s now, okay? So there were other people. There's General Scowcroft. He just stepped down from being Ronald Reagan's national security advisor. So they're having their shrimp cocktail, right? And Scowcroft says, Admiral Poindexter, my successor as national security advisor, he goes before Congress on Tuesday, and were I advising him, I would tell him to tell Congress we never told Ronald Reagan anything. And everybody goes, well, but Bob... And this is right from Bob. He says, I just involuntarily dropped my fork. It split my shrimp cocktail dish. And I said, General Scowcroft, are you saying that you would advise your successor to perjure himself before Congress? Now, there was, Bob says, there was silence for about, it seemed like a minute, but probably maybe 20 seconds. And then the head of Newsweek put his arm around Bob. He said, now, Bob, sometimes you have to do what's best for the country. And then there was this, this gentlemanly, well, they were all men anyway, gentlemanly laughter. So we know what's best for the country. Bob, you're new down here, but you'll learn. Well, Bob never learned that part of the business, all right? Bob couldn't tolerate it. It was soon thereafter that he set up his own website, the longest that we know of, the longest lasting and the earliest website for investigative reporting. And one of the happiest, one of the luckiest things in my life was to run into Bob and have him recruit me to write and to learn the journalist trade from him, because intelligence analysts, they have to make judgments on the basis of incomplete evidence, sometimes just one source. Bob wouldn't allow that. And Bob told me a lot of other things about the craft of journalism, for which I'm very grateful.
Okay, Ray, I wanted to ask you one more question. I know that Bob Perry is probably most famous for his Iran-Contra stories. Is there anything he's done since the founding of this independent news site, Consortium News, that you think is equally noteworthy, if underappreciated?
Sure. You know, there are certain key junctures which change history. Now, in the election of 1968, it was down to the wire, Nixon against Humphrey. LBJ had decided he didn't want to run. He was tired of his Vietnam stuff, okay? Now, what happens? Well, to his credit, and to the credit of Humphrey and the others, they get the North Vietnamese to agree to come to Paris. They're going to talk about things. There's, you know, talk about a bombing wall and all this stuff. And they're about to do that about a week before the election. And guess what? They say, no, we're not going to do it. Now, guess what happens? The next day, J. Edgar Hoover appears in LBJ's office, and he says, "Mr. President, I don't know how to tell you this, but the South Vietnamese people are talking to Nixon folks, and the Nixon folks have told them, don't come to Paris, don't come to Paris, that we don't want Humphrey to win. It looked like progress in Vietnam. You put off coming to Paris, and we'll give you a better deal." And so they did. Okay, now, so LBJ says, "How do you know that?" J. Edgar Hoover says, "Wiretaps. We got chapter verse how this is done, and it works. So there's going to be no progress on Vietnam before the election. And this will have an effect on Humphrey." Now, this is 2 days before the election. What does LBJ do? He doesn't give a rat's patootie about whether Humphrey wins or not. He convenes his wise men, Clark, Clifford, the establishment, and they say, "Well, now, if you reveal this and Nixon wins anyway, you'll be impeding the President of the United States from doing his job, so maybe you ought to just be quiet about it." And they were quiet about it, and Nixon won. Now, how did Buff find out about that? Well, they had a tip, and the tip was, go down into the LBJ library and ask for the Rostow envelope. So Bob does. He goes down and talks to the custodian there. He says, "Okay, give me, please, I'd like to have the Rostow envelope." The guy looks at him. He says, "What do you know about that?" He says, "Just give me the Rostow envelope." So the guy gives it to him. He says, "But it's not supposed to be released for 50 years. Bob says, "Come on." So he gives it. It's right there. It's all in Rostow's papers. Okay? It's right there. The whole business about how the FBI learned about this, how LBJ didn't give a rat's patootie, and how nothing was done before the election. Now, here's a little sidebar. There's ample evidence that when Nixon was raiding Brookings Institution, almost, and other places, what was he looking for? He was looking for that envelope. Now, that's not a conclusive thing. We don't have wiretaps or anything about that. But when you try to figure out why Nixon was so eager to break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, or the plan to break into Brookings and steal something, well, that's what they were after. They knew that there was something left behind. They didn't know exactly what it was, but they knew that it would discredit them from the get-go. So that's a big find. Now, so Bob publishes that on consortiumnews.com. You don't hear anything in mainstream media. And then 6 months later, some guy picks it up as if it's his own, right? And he says, "Oh, here's a revelation." And some woman picks it up, you know. So he was never out for credit, but he was out for attention. He wanted people to read this major, major finding. Well, they are now, but nobody knows that it was Bob Perry's paperwork that dug this out. And he was so good at digging. He dug where other people didn't, investigative reporter, intelligence analyst, that's what we all do. And when you get documents, that's what we lust after, for God's sake, documentary evidence. So people held Bob in the highest esteem. And those people include people like Cy Hirsch, people like Dan Ellsberg, people who know which end is up in the journalism world. And they're crushed now to have to do all this stuff without Bob. Because the thing about Bob is he did it two or three times a week. Cy Hirsch, preeminent investigative reporter, as good as Bob Perry in his own way, couldn't get anything published in English. And so Bob, at least, was able to get his stuff and my stuff and the other stuff out in a way that people could assimilate it, people could read it and learn from it, even though the contests with the major media and even with the alternative media was David and Goliath Kondek.
That was former CIA analyst and regular ConsortiumNews.com contributor, Ray McGovern. You're listening to a special broadcast on the life and legacy of the recently deceased independent investigative journalist, Robert Perry, on the Global Research NewsHour. Broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and podcast online at the site globalresearch.ca. The show is also heard on our affiliate stations across Canada and the United States. 68-year-old Robert Perry, editor and publisher of ConsortiumNews.com, died peacefully. According to a post on the site written by his son, Nat Perry, he had recently endured debilitating strokes over the last several weeks. Though the elder Perry had suspected that strokes may have resulted from a hectic period of reporting on the events rocking Washington, D.C., doctors determined his condition was related to undiagnosed pancreatic cancer, with which he had unknowingly been living for 4 to 5 years. ConsortiumNews.com will apparently continue on with its particular brand of dissident journalism in spite of its founder's departure, as Nat Perry spelled out in his January 28th post on the site. "Readers should rest assured that despite my dad's death, every effort will be made to ensure that the website will continue going strong. Indeed, I think that everyone involved with this project wants to uphold the same commitment to truth-telling without fear or favor that inspired Bob and his heroes like George Seldes, I.F. Stone, and Thomas Paine." The Global Research News Hour reached out to Nat Perry to comment on his famous father and the unique qualities he exemplified in life. Nat Perry, thank you so much for joining us. And again, my condolences over the unexpected death of your father.
Well, thank you for that. It's good to be with you.
And you wrote a very impressive article on the 28th of January, shortly after he died. And you mentioned, one point that stands out is when you were a child and you were talking to him, as he was leaving for one of his assignments in Central America. And you, he was straight with you, and he's talking about how he had a duty to report on these stories about people, children being killed, and including kids like yourself, in mm-hmm. response to the question. So I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about this. He didn't do much to, he was. Gentle but respectful. Right. At the same time, he didn't sugarcoat things. He was straight with you, in other words, yeah. about some of the things that he did. And that's interesting, considering that you would think that a parent would have a tendency to want to protect their children from some unpleasant realities in the world that we live in.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, that's sort of what I was getting at, with that anecdote that I decided to share in the piece that I wrote from when my father passed, was because that's what really stood out to me. I mean, as a very, one of my earliest childhood memories. I think it sort of encapsulated his approach to journalism in not only this duty that he felt he had to go, go into these dangerous places and tell the stories of people who were suffering under, from U.S. foreign policy in Central America at the time. But also the way you're exactly like, as you said, he didn't sugarcoat it with me as a probably 5 or 6 year old. I'm guessing that was probably 1981. So I was 5 or 6 years old. And you're right. I mean, he really just kind of told me straight what was happening there. And I think that sort of was his philosophy of journalism that you tell the truth no matter what, some probably would, question that, maybe that approach to parenting. I'm actually the father of a 6-year-old daughter now, and I she's at the age where, she's becoming more and more curious about the world, but I haven't really told her yet about the realities of the world, the horrors of war and that sort of thing, and it's something that, at some point they're going to have to learn about. But I think my dad's approach was very much to tell the truth, it definitely had an effect on me. I remember at the time, as I mentioned in my article, that I said, like, you mean kids just like me? And he said, yep, just like you. And I think that really stuck with me personally, because I've always sort of thought about the children and the innocent victims of wars that the U.S. has funded or participated in, and that's what you really should keep in mind when we're talking about these conflicts and these policies, that you know, it's real people being affected, and it's, you know, children we're talking about, you know, mothers. And so, yeah, that that really was his approach to it. And, I mean, he was definitely, you know, affected. You know, he'd come back. So that anecdote I shared about him leaving, you know, for the trip, you know, that was one side of it. I remember him coming back and also, you know, sharing stories around the dinner table. And, you know, yeah, he was really he was very affected by those conflicts and what he saw down in Central America. And, you know, he wrote very important stories about it. And a lot of these stories, you know, that he and colleagues, you know, were writing ended up leading to Congress banning the, you know, banning U.S. aid to the Contras, which then led to all these techniques they were using to get around these legal restrictions and, you know, leading to the Iran-Contra affair and Contra cocaine and all the rest of it. So it really did sort of shape his career. And, you know, it's something that, you know, as he was, you know, dying, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I was really reflecting on a lot of that. And so I guess that was sort of what inspired me to write this piece and to share some of my memories about it.
Now, I was wondering if maybe as a young man, you might have approached him and asked, you know, what should I do with my life? And maybe in those mm-hmm. conversations, you might have heard him mention his own inspiration or motivation for the particular kind of journalism that he did. I mean, what did he tell you? Was it Watergate? Was it an article that he'd written or something that he'd experienced? So what do you understand of what put him on the particular trajectory that he set forth on?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, I do remember asking him one time about, you know, I was always interested in journalism, and, you know, I did ask for advice on whether maybe if he thought that a degree in journalism would make sense, and you know, he sort of advised against that. I do remember I was a history major, and I was thinking about, you know, switching majors or something. He said, no, you know, stick with, you know, learning as much as you can about the world. You know, anyone can develop the skills that you need to be a journalist by digging. You know, his view was you don't really need to go to journalism school for that. He never did, actually. He was an English major in college. But, you know, like these... the tools that he used of, you know, reading every document that you get your hands on, and interviewing, you know, asking the right questions and interviews and all that sort of thing. You know, he would say those are skills that anyone can have. So, but you know, when it comes to his inspirations, I mean, he was certainly inspired, I think, as a young man by the independent press in the 60s, you know, the Ramparts magazine, he would talk about sometimes, in I.F. Stone, Izzy Stone, which is a independent journalist during the Vietnam War. And, you know, so those were his heroes. He came out of the Watergate era, and, you know, I think that was definitely, you know, a big influence on him was... you know, the Woodward and Bernstein approach, and so I think, you know, he was inspired by, you know, those kind of truth tellers. But I think what he saw in the 80s was, you know, very shrinking space for that kind of journalism. You know, that it just, you know, over the years of through the 80s especially, it just became more and more restricted in what, you know, what you could report. And leading eventually to him founding this independent website, consortiumnews.com.
He'd actually participated in a PBS documentary for Frontline, a PBS Frontline series that mm-hmm. Seemed to mark a bit of a departure. Accepting this assignment that's when he seemed to be first at odds with sort of the mainstream journalistic fraternity. And he seemed to express some reservations about taking that particular approach. I mean, do you want to maybe just expand a little bit on some of the sure. the thought processes he was going through, as you understand it?
Yeah, he kept pursuing these stories from the 80s and the Iran-Contra stories, and And a lot of, as time went on, especially after the Iran-Contra hearings had ended, I think it was, the consensus was, okay, that's over and done with, time to move on. And especially, when Bill Clinton came in, there was a, sort of a new era in Washington, sort of basically wanting to move on from those years. And I guess that was about the time that he got this assignment from PBS Frontline, and he never really, as far as I understand, when it came to this story, he was investigating the October Surprise mystery, which is related to the Reagan campaign's efforts in 1980 to undercut President Carter's negotiations to free the 52 American hostages that are being held in Tehran. And this is a rumor that had been going around for years, and he was assigned to investigate it. And as far as I know, his approach was always, he was never a conspiracy theorist who, believed that it happened. He was doing his job and interviewing all the relevant people and trying to determine, the timeline, because all the Reagan people had alibis basically, where they were claiming that they weren't where they would have. There was a meeting that allegedly was happening in Paris. And, basically he was checking out alibis and trying to figure out, trying to piece this together. There's a mystery, basically, And I guess it was really at that time when he was working on this that a lot of his colleagues started, or they would tell him basically that his reputation in Washington was suffering because he was working on the story and he was being seen increasingly as a conspiracy theorist. Which I think is a label that he, had to live with for a long time. And I guess it sort of went from there. And if I remember, that was probably, I think, his last real job in the mainstream media. Like he, then he worked for a while at the Nation magazine and some different progressive magazines. And and then eventually decided to start his own project, which he had a magazine for a while as well as a newsletter and a website. So it was a real sort of multimedia project.
There was another journalist who followed up on your father's reporting on the Contra cocaine networking scandal, the Gary Webb, and that was a very tragic story because not only did he find the journalistic community, including his own reporter at San Jose Mercury Press, turning on him, but he ultimately ended up dying by suicide in 2004. Your father dealt with Gary Webb. I mean, he communicated to him during those trying times. What are your recollections of those interactions? How did they affect your dad?
He was, I remember when, before Gary Webb published the story, he reached out to my dad. My dad was, he and Brian Barger had been the two journalists that had previously done the most work on that, on the story of the Contra cocaine smuggling. Gary Webb was looking at more of the U.S. side of it, where the cocaine went once it was in the U.S. So it was sort of a natural sort of progression from my dad's work. And so they were in contact, before that went to press. And my dad, he warned him or, kind of cautioned him early on. This is a very, dangerous story. And he asked him how his relationship was with his editors. And Gary thought, he said, oh, my, they'll support me. His impression was that they had his back the whole way and everything. But of course, once the big media decided to pile on and try to poke holes in the story. Eventually, the editor of San Jose Mercury News, Jerry Sepos, kind of threw him under the bus and retracted the story, issued a mea culpa, and Gary's life was never the same. So it was they were in close contact, and I think my dad sympathized with him very much because he had experienced similar, had similar experiences with colleagues and editors in the 80s. And so he felt some affinity with him, but also a great appreciation for what Gary Webb did. I mean, the CIA ended up doing their own internal investigation, and they issued their own report, which confirmed most of the basic allegations that, these Contras were involved in drug trafficking, and that the Reagan administration and the CIA looked the other way. So, actually, because of all of, following all that, my dad decided to launch an award named in Gary Webb's honor, which there have been two recipients, my brother, who helped set up the Consortium News website, and Oliver Stone was the second recipient, which I believe he got the award last year at an event in Washington.
Now, you mentioned the term conspiracy theorist and how that was a term that dogged your father. I imagine when we come into the current era with the Ukraine situation, the right-wing push, as he reported on it, and a lot of the stories there, the questioning of the chemical gas attack in Syria as having been by President Assad, Russiagate, all of these sorts of stories probably didn't help in terms of that label of a conspiracy theorist. Did that wash off your father's back? Had he long ago kind of given up on that, or was it an ongoing concern for him, not just professionally as a journalist trying to do his job, but personally?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's a bit tricky. I mean, his approach to everything was, follow the evidence. You have to, if you have an allegation, you need evidence to back it up, and if not, then you can't make the allegation. And so I think he was a real stickler. And he actually, I remember during the Bush years after 9/11, he had a lot of issues with the 9/11 truther community, and something that he never really felt the evidence was strong in regards to this, the idea of an inside job being behind 9/11. So he went against those conspiracy theorists at that time, and so I guess it's always been a bit of a back and forth in terms of his relationship with some of these conspiracy theories. But I know that I think it did affect him towards in recent years, having generally throughout most of his career been exposing Republican wrongdoing, and therefore having a lot of support from the Democratic liberal establishment. And then a lot of things kind of changing, especially in the later years of the Obama administration, when Ukraine became a big issue, and the U.S. policy in that regard, and as you said, Syria. He went up against the Democratic establishment, and especially after after the election with Trump. I mean, the whole Russiagate narrative, something he just didn't feel that the evidence was there, And honestly, it's not. I mean, we have, people can disagree, I think, on what they believe happened with that election. But so far, they haven't produced the evidence that Russia actually, hacked the emails of the DNC. And all these stories, it's a lot of smoke. But, when you look closely at each one, they're sort of lacking evidence. And so I think, that's been his principle. That was his principle all along, in terms of following the evidence. And it made him a lot of enemies in some respect, but that's what also made him popular, and why a lot of people respected him, regardless of their ideology. And following his death, I've received all these messages, and you can read on the website, all the comments. A lot of them will start off saying, I'm a arch paleo conservative, and I disagree with Bob Perry on a lot of issues, but I've always respected his journalism and his truth telling and that sort of thing, because that's the way he always approached it. So
that was Nat Perry, son of Robert Perry, and current editor of ConsortiumNews.com. The Global Research News Hour had the distinct privilege of interviewing Mr. Perry on several occasions. Our last interview with him was recorded in early December, less than a month before his first debilitating stroke. Here he is, recounting his thoughts on the decline of the journalistic profession in America in the last three decades and the need to support and protect independent journalism and sites like ConsortiumNews.com.
When I came, the national press in Washington was still influenced by what had happened in the 70s, particularly the Watergate scandal and the stories about Vietnam, the Pentagon Papers. So there was a real skepticism that many mainstream journalists brought to what they were hearing from the U.S. government, and that was sort of a healthy thing. I mean, there are obviously cases where it went overboard, and other times when there wasn't enough skepticism. But there was more of that mix back then. As we got through the 80s, 1980s, the Reagan administration was very aggressive in trying to put this more independent press back in line. They spent a lot of time and effort, what they call perception management. And they realized that if they could control how the mainstream press was reporting stories, it would also help them control the American people, who had gotten also a bit out of control in the 1970s and the late 60s. So there was that sort of reality that was beginning to emerge. And as we get into the 90s, there was a veering away from any kind of serious journalism at all. Mostly was focused on more personality issues, Bill Clinton's sex life, and there was kind of a trivialization of the news. And then, of course, you get into the period of the 9/11 and the George W. Bush administration, where the press, mainstream press, simply failed to do its due diligence in terms of trying to check on what the claims were about the Iraq War. There was this more and more pressure to get in line, to be quote patriotic, as if that was sort of the role of journalists to take the side of the U.S. government and not question the U.S. government too much. And we've now moved through this era where there is now this attitude of that the press should get on board and get rid of Donald Trump.
It seems as if we have so many choices, including the internet, that there seems to have been a shrinking in terms of the areas of allowable investigation or news that, you know, as the New York Times masthead would say, is fit to print. Does that not seem a little bit contradictory?
Well, I think you have different forces at play. Obviously, you have economic forces, which tended to lead toward a greater consolidation of the news media as we knew it. So you had, in many cases, the number of family newspapers and various, somewhat alternative views, even if they weren't as ideological, perhaps, but they were more idiosyncratic. You had different families running different papers, and some had different points of view. That was pretty much wiped out as the corporatization of the press went forward. But you did have, on the other hand, you had some more more first cable outlets appearing, and then you also had the emergence of the internet. And as I was sort of finding it harder and harder to operate within the confines of the mainstream press in the 90s, that's when the internet sort of became available to us. There was the ability of the American people and the world public to access more and more diverse opinion. And now we're seeing a real pushback against that. And I think one of the darkest elements of the Russiagate brouhaha has been that a side of that has been to use that as an excuse to begin to silence the independence of the internet. Starting almost a year ago, when there was a front page story in the Washington Post based on an anonymous group called Prop or Not. And this group decided that they were going to pick 200 internet sites, including Consortium News, which they would just deem Russian propaganda. And I guess the reason we fell into that was that we had been skeptical about a number of claims or narratives coming out of the State Department. And that includes things like back in the 2000s of the Iraq War. We were skeptical of that. But we were also skeptical of some of the claims being made by Obama's State Department and how they were presenting the Syrian conflict, for instance, how they were presenting the Ukraine conflict. And what we were pushing for was a more thorough, objective, multi-sided view of those conflicts, not the Johnny one-note approach that the State Department was trying to take. But because of that, we were lumped in, these 200 sites that were deemed propaganda. The Washington Post runs this on the front page. The group is anonymous. They don't have to identify themselves as proper not group. And that was sort of a marker of where we were headed. And since then, there was more and more pressure on Google and Facebook to begin to de-rank, as they would put it, or isolate, marginalize Internet sites, no matter how good they were, no matter how serious their journalism was. But if they were going in a different direction from what the New York Times was saying was true or the Washington Post was saying was true, there's been a determination to try to silence that, to shut it down. In journalism, we used to pride ourselves in presenting both sides of the story. That was what I learned in journalism. You always want to present both sides of a story, maybe multiple sides of a story, because that way the American people are given the choices. They can decide if they want to agree with this or that. That's the idea of democracy. It's the idea of the Enlightenment. But now the major news organizations in the United States and these major technology companies have teamed up with a goal of preventing that. Mm-hmm. You're only supposed to hear what is approved for you to hear. You see, what you're getting is now a less of a menu of choices in terms of trying to understand the world. And that's what the Internet had promised us, and there was the hope we had. And increasingly now, in the past year, under this umbrella of Russiagate, we are seeing a reversal.
Bob Perry's family encourages listeners and well-wishers looking to honor Robert Perry's memory in lieu of flowers to make a tax-deductible donation to the Consortium for Independent Journalism at consortiumnews.com. That's it for this week's show. Next week, we will be hosting a fundraiser for CKUW 95.9 FM, the Winnipeg-based radio station that produces the Global Research News Hour. This will be a live broadcast airing February 16th, 2018 at 1 p.m. Central Time. We will be encouraging donations to foster support for the station, which offers a platform for the alternative news and views that have become standard on this radio program. To donate online, please visit the site fundrive.ckuw.ca. Many thanks this week to our guests, as well as our affiliate stations across Canada and the U.S., which also broadcast the show. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. We conclude with music suggested by Nat Perry. This is a poignant Grateful Dead song from the album American Beauty. It's called Box of Rain.
Sky.